You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, John Schwartz. John's new job is at The Intercept, where he has been doing a ton of wonderful reporting and blogging. He previously worked for Michael Moore's Dog Eat Dog Films and was research producer for Moore's Capitalism, A Love Story. He's contributed to many publications, including The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Atlantic, The Wall Street Journal, Mother Jones, and Slate, as well as NPR and Saturday Night Live. In 2003, he collected on a $1,000 bet that Iraq would have no weapons of mass destruction. Who knew? John Schwartz, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
David, hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
It's wonderful to have you on. Don't know why we haven't done it sooner. Have been reading great stuff you've been writing at The Intercept, which I recommend to everyone, including you wrote a review of this new book called The Devil's Chessboard and went off on some related topics. And I think I may have read your review before I went and grabbed the book and read it, which I'm grateful for because it was well worth doing and people should get The Devil's Chessboard. But can you describe what this story was about and what interested you in it?
Yeah, I would encourage everybody listening to this to go get The Devil's Chessboard. The full name is The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. And it's by David Talbot, who people probably know from Salon, which he founded. And Talbot has said, and you will really be able to tell this if you pick the book up, that he is writing not just a biography of Alan Dulles' public and private life, but really a biography of the U.S. national security state after World War II and how it took over the world. And it is really, really fascinating. It goes into all kinds of detail about a million little corners of history that I will admit I knew nothing about in many cases. Like, I thought I knew most of the dreadful things that the U.S. government had did, and it turns out that I was completely wrong.
Well, what were some of the most dreadful things you didn't know about?
One of the stories that I was not familiar with was the story of Jesus de Galindez. I hope that I'm pronouncing his name right, given that the United States killed him. He was a lecturer at Columbia University in New York, as well as an opponent of the dictator of the Dominican Republic during the 40s and 50s. And the dictator of the Dominican Republic despised him, but unfortunately for Galindez, he was also, the dictator was, a good friend and ally of the United States, the CIA and Alan Dulles in particular. And someone, the story is not completely clear, we'll never know the details for sure, but someone kidnapped Galindez from Manhattan and took him to an airfield on Long Island and flew him from there to the Dominican Republic, where he was tortured and eventually, as far as it's possible to tell with these kinds of things, fed sharks. And it's actually even worse than that, because the dictator and the various people around him in his government were very concerned about the American who had flown the guy who they tortured and killed to the Dominican Republic. So then they killed him. And then after that, they claimed that the pilot had been killed by somebody else and arrested the guy who they claimed had killed the pilot. And then that guy somehow committed suicide in his cell. So it's just an incredibly lurid, awful story, and demonstrates that really no one anywhere in the United States was, and perhaps still is, safe from these people.
Indeed, it's not clear what exactly has changed since some of these horrors occurred. But it seems to me in U.S. society, you know, boiling someone in oil and chopping them up and feeding them to sharks and so forth is not quite as bad as anything Nazi. You know, if a Nazi were to do it, then it would be really, really bad. And so I think of particular interest to a lot of people would be the Nazi connections of Alan Dulles.
Yeah, that's right. And my theory about the United States and the hold that Nazis have over our imagination is that it all goes back to Raiders of the Lost Ark, and that Raiders of the Lost Ark comprises essentially all of the history that many Americans know. And so they've seen Raiders of the Lost Ark, and they know that the Nazis seem to be really, really bad guys. So if you tell them that something is connected with the Nazis, then they think of like, oh, well, those guys were really mean to Harrison Ford, so I hate them.
I'm pretty sure the obsession predates Raiders of the Lost Ark, but I think it may be a good summary, as you say, of how Americans view history. And they view history as largely good and peaceful and tranquil until Nazism spontaneously generated out of nowhere stood up against everything good about American values, and the United States, with very little help from anyone else, defeated it and must go on defeating it from here to eternity. How does the story of Alan Dulles's career conflict with that?
Yes, well, you really need to understand this to understand anything about politics in the United States, really world history. Because Alan Dulles, together with his brother John Foster Dulles, were corporate lawyers at the beginning of their career. And they represented many of the biggest corporations in the United States. They also had a significant international practice. And among the corporations that they represented overseas were German corporations. And so they represented, you know, sort of U.S. multinationals that had interests in Germany, as well as just German corporations. And when Hitler came to power, no one ever says this in polite society now, but when Hitler came to power, there were many sectors of the United States who thought this was pretty good news. And Alan Dulles and his brother John Foster were among them. Eventually, Alan Dulles, actually before his brother, decided that they would have to cut ties with Adolf Hitler, that things weren't going as well as they'd anticipated. But this was really, really late in the 30s. And while they cut formal ties, they did not really want to leave all of this money on the table that they'd made from representing the U.S. multinationals and the German corporations. So they kept in close touch with all of their former clients. And during the war, they did some things that I think many people would consider to be treason. They were supporting various factions of Nazi Germany in various ways. And towards the end of World War II, Alan Dulles actually tried to create a sort of separate peace with Nazi Germany in Italy. Italian partisans had captured a high-ranking Nazi official, and he actually sent people to rescue him because he didn't like...
Alan Dulles sent people to rescue the Nazi official.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's described in great detail in David Talbot's book. And the reason Alan Dulles was doing this was that FDR had stated that the United States had a policy of complete surrender, that the Nazis would have to surrender completely for the war to end. And part of the reason for that was to reassure the Soviet Union that we were not going to try to make a separate peace with Nazi Germany. And Alan Dulles, for sure, his brother probably as well, didn't like that because they actually saw the Soviet Union as a bigger threat than Nazi Germany, and they would have been very happy to make a separate peace with them and then sort of forge an alliance that they would then be able to use against the Soviet Union after the war. And, of course, that's exactly what happened. Although Alan Dulles was not successful in what he tried to do in Italy in terms of making a formal separate peace, in effect, that is what happened after World War II, that the United States was very cozy with some of the worst remaining Nazis. These included Reinhard Gehlen, who was the head of Nazi intelligence on the Eastern Front, which is where many of the very worst Nazi atrocities happened, for sure. And Dulles was good friends with Reinhard Gehlen and made sure that he was able to survive the war, that he was not tried for war crimes, and then put him in charge of West Germany's intelligence service. And from that point on, you know, this very, very significant big-time Nazi was one of the CIA's closest allies in West Germany.
We're speaking with John Schwartz, who writes at The Intercept. John, in your review of this book, I mean, you could have gone any one of a thousand ways, and I think people need to read the book, The Devil's Chessboard. But you actually wrote about something I was unfamiliar with and was not in the book at all, called the Safari Club. Can you tell people what that was?
Yeah, the Safari Club is this amazing piece of lost history. And the reason I brought it up is this, is that, you know, Alan Dulles, survives World War II, manages to sort of cement this policy with the United States being allies with significant remnants of Nazi Germany. Then Alan Dulles becomes head of the CIA when Eisenhower is elected, stays as head of the CIA for 8 years, remains as head of the CIA when Kennedy is elected until Kennedy fires him. And during that time, John Foster was Secretary of State. So you have these people who are at the very top of the U.S. government, and they believe that they know how the world should be run. And in fact, Alan Dulles, in his only run for office, was quoted as saying, "Democracy only works if the so-called intelligent people make it work. You can't sit back and let democracy run itself." And so the Dulles brothers had this very straightforward view of how the world should work, and it should be run by them, and just regular people shouldn't really have any say in it. And what happened after Dulles' death in the 1970s, as many people may know, is that there were finally very significant investigations by the U.S. U.S. national security state by Congress. And finally, there was some light shed on what had been going on for the previous 25 years. And all the governments that we'd overthrown, MKUltra, which is also covered in The Devil's Chessboard, this extremely ugly history that most Americans knew nothing about. So what happened then? Well, it became much harder from the mid-70s through the Carter administration, but that lasts until 1980, for this intelligence world to do all of the things that it had done before. And that meant that there were lots of people who were sort of left in the lurch in various countries, like Saudi Arabia and France and Iran, still then under the Shah. They had built alliances with the intelligence world in the United States and the U.S. right wing, and they were concerned that they weren't going to be able to have the United States helping them run the world anymore. And so they got together, Saudi Arabia and France were the main players, and created something called the Safari Club. That was actually their own name. And the idea was that with the United States not sort of taking its formal leading role, that they would get together and fund the things the United States had done previously. And that lasted from the mid-70s until the election of Ronald Reagan. And in fact, it was in many ways very well known to the United States. It was approved in many ways by the United States. But the money didn't have to be appropriated by Congress, and that was the most significant difference, that these people could just sort of do whatever they wanted because they didn't have to get money from Congress. And what that demonstrates is that in this world, like, we have no say over what these people do. You know, we can have Congress investigate them. We can have Congress try to shut them down. But it doesn't matter. They just go get money from other places. And in fact, the same kind of thing happened during the 1980s when Congress tried to shut down the Contras in Nicaragua in a similar fashion. They just reran the same game plan as with the Safari Club. They went and got the money from Saudi Arabia.
Although that one became a public scandal.
Yes, that did become a public scandal. That's much better known than the Safari Club. And the Safari Club is amusingly not known even to people who work for the New York Times or the Washington Post. The guy who used to be the Mideast bureau chief for the Washington Post was once asked about the Safari Club in an online chat and said he'd never heard of it.
Was it known to Jimmy Carter?
It almost certainly was, yeah. I mean, Carter's foreign policy was much more conservative and right-wing than most people understand now. I think that his relationship with them was almost certainly a little more dicey than would eventually be the case with the Reagan administration, but he did know about them as far as anybody can tell.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. I want to back up in time again a little bit before we leave the Devil's Chessboard, even though there's like 85 other topics I hope we can get to in the next several minutes. But the whole point of the Devil's Chessboard, this book by Talbot, is, I think, to get to the assassination of Kennedy. And, you know, much of the book is building up sort of the character and history of Alan Dulles. But the conclusion is all about the assassination of Kennedy, which it has him masterminding and coordinating from the CIA's training camp, the farm there near Williamsburg, Virginia. The case he makes seems to be in agreement with a lot of recent Kennedy assassination books, including Jim Douglas's, and with the so-called deathbed confession by Howard Hunt. I wonder what you make of that case, which seems to be really the point of the book.
Yeah, it is largely the point of the book, that the whole book is building up to that. What I found most interesting, and for me personally newest about the book, was the information about the attempts actually on Charles de Gaulle's life just in the couple of years before Kennedy was assassinated. And what's interesting about that is that we do know for sure that the assassination attempt on de Gaulle were run by various right-wing elements within the French intelligence world and the French military. There's no question about that. And Talbot describes a lot of what seems to be the possible collaboration or knowledge of the assassination attempt on Dulles' part. And he certainly makes the case that this is the kind of thing, you know, assassinating leaders in Western democracies, that's what we want to call them, was something that Alan Dulles would consider. And Dulles, of course, had a very obvious motive, a personal motive, in the sense that Kennedy had fired him after the Bay of Pigs had been unsuccessful. And he also had the ideological motive of people within his circles, his class, and you can imagine it just by thinking about the world right now, where many people listening to this might think of Barack Obama as actually fairly conservative and someone kind of like Dwight Eisenhower or something like that. But to the U.S. right wing right now, Barack Obama is a secret Muslim who is trying to destroy the United States. And the same kind of people were around in 1963, and they thought that Kennedy was trying to destroy the United States and surrender to the Soviet Union and secretly a communist. And so these people are kind of nuts. And this is where I would differ from someone like Noam Chomsky, who talks about how, you know, the policies of the Kennedy administration were pretty conservative and not that different from what the U.S. military and intelligence world may have wanted. And that is true. But what you have to understand is that the people in the intelligence world and the military world are not Noam Chomsky. And from their perspective, not doing 100% of what they want means that you're a traitor. And in their mind, are a secret communist or a secret Muslim today, that's just the way they see the world because they're pretty insane. And so Talbot makes a very strong case that Alan Dulles and the people around him had the motive, they had certainly the experience that would allow them to arrange a political assassination. I don't know whether he, makes the case that we can say for sure that Alan Dulles did it. I don't think that anybody can make that case now. But he certainly uncovers a lot of suggestive information. And as you mentioned, one particularly odd part of that information is that after Kennedy was assassinated, Dulles spent that weekend at the CIA's farm in Northern Virginia doing who knows what. You can imagine an innocent explanation because the president had just been killed and he'd been the head of the CIA, so you might want somebody like that around. But it's still pretty peculiar.
Yeah, he repeatedly says Northern Virginia, which is kind of strange if you've ever been to Virginia. The farm is actually in southeastern Virginia near Williamsburg.
I'm going to blame my mistake just now on David Talbot.
No, you should, because he repeatedly says that, and it's very strange, as if Northern Virginia doesn't have enough to be ashamed of, including Dulles Airport, you know. I think you make a very good point that there are people who view, I don't know if they are in the same positions of power within the U.S. government and CIA, but there certainly are people who view Barack Obama in just the same way, although someone could make the case, well, then why haven't they killed him? But I think that the case for Kennedy having opposed the military-industrial complex spy complex significantly is perhaps stronger than with most other pseudo-left-wing socialist commie presidents that we've seen in the United States. Kennedy really stood up against them on a number of key points related to Cuba and Vietnam and Berlin and so forth. And what came out for me in Talbot's book was the extent to which Kennedy also had a domestic agenda of supporting labor rights and opposing plutocratic demands that was just the sort of thing that was getting foreign presidents killed in those countries that have U.S. embassies in them. I wonder if there isn't really a stronger case that Kennedy provided motivation to these guys than there is with someone like Obama.
I think there is that case to be made, although I would also be a little bit leery of believing that David Talbot gives a complete picture of Kennedy, because Kennedy said a whole bunch of different things, and he did a whole bunch of different things. And the things that Talbot mentions are the ones that people like us would read about and say, hey, that's great, he's our kind of guy. But there's a lot of other things that Kennedy did that were pretty dreadful, and those are generally left out of the book. But, as I say, it doesn't really matter from the perspective of the motivation of the people from the military intelligence and intelligence world, because they don't perceive the world very accurately, and not getting 100% of what they want is enough for them to want to kill you.
Yeah. You pointed out to me recently, John, an audio clip of a comment from Senator Rockefeller that I think goes to the point you made a few minutes ago about, there just is no way to fight back. The extent to which this spy military complex controls things. Let's just listen to that clip.
How do you understand the way intelligence works? Do you think that because I'm chairman of the Intelligence Committee that I just say, I want it, give it to me? They control it, all of it, all of it, all the time. I only get, and my committee only gets, what they want to give me.
John Schwartz, what do you make of that comment?
Yeah, so that is a clip from 2007 when a reporter named Charles Davis, who I think at the time, 24 and had read an article by Seymour Hersh about how the Bush administration was trying to conduct clandestine operations aimed at Iran. And Congress, according to Hersh, didn't know anything about this, and this was really dangerous because it could have led to war between the United States and Iran, right as we were in the middle of the worst part of the Iraq War. And so Charles Davis went to the Capitol and asked Jay Rockefeller, what do you know about this? And Rockefeller gave him that amazing response that just because he's the head of the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, that doesn't mean he knows anything about intelligence in the United States.
And yet he knows enough to denounce all sorts of crimes and to have been involved with this torture report that I saw on a post on your website, TheIntercept.com, recently, pointing out that no one has yet seen it and they may destroy it. We've only seen the 500-page summary. Is there a point in fighting these battles, in demanding to see that actual report, in demanding more transparency, in demanding clean money in elections, and sort of pushing back against corruption and secrecy? Or did you really mean it when you said that, you know, we have no way to oppose this machine?
Well, what I think these stories demonstrate is how hard it is to oppose these machines. But even with the Safari Club in the 1970s, like, the fact that they had to do all of this off the books and the United States was not funding it was, from their perspective, a significant blow. And that means that everything that we can do isn't pointless. It's just a really, really big problem, and much bigger than they tell you in your high school history class.
We've got just a minute left, and I wanted to cover so many other topics. But one of the ideas that you've been promoting that I wish others were as well is this idea of cleaning up the money with small donations. Can you describe that briefly?
Yeah. So very quickly, the Supreme Court has said, you know, we can't keep the money of the top 1% out of the election, but there's now a bill in Congress that's sponsored actually by almost all the government, by almost all the Democrats, called Government by the People. It was written by John Sarbanes. He's a Maryland Democrat. And what it would do is provide matching funds for small donors. So if you're able to give $50 to a candidate, that's matched 6-1. So that turns into $350 for the candidate. And that actually would change the dynamic enormously. I live in New York City, and it makes everything different in terms of people running for mayor and people running for the city council. So please look that up, the Government by the People Act, written by John Sarbanes. It's one of the most encouraging things about money in politics, right?
Because New York locally has a similar setup going now?
That's right. New York was the first place to have this kind of system, and it actually does make a very significant difference in who can run and who they listen to once they're in office.
John Schwartz, check him out at TheIntercept.com. Read what he writes and read the books that he writes about. John, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersmith.
To Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, alleged San Bernardino killers Syed Farouk and Tashfeen Malik did not pledge allegiance to ISIS on social media, the FBI now says. But no matter, the California killings have already added fuel to an upsurge of Islamophobia in U.S. media and politics that in some ways is worse than that seen in the wake of September 11th, 2001. One new element is this murky idea of radicalization. We'll talk about that with Arun Kundani, adjunct professor at NYU and author of, most recently, The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. Also on the show, U.S. media had a lot of worries about the recent elections in Venezuela, allegations of fraud and an unfair advantage for the Maduro government were rampant, though the opposition party ended up ahead. Meanwhile, the same sorts of concerns, with greater foundation, were being raised in Haiti to decidedly less elite media interest. We'll discuss a tale of two elections with journalist and activist Keen Bott. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at the week's press. A lot of the questions asked by journalists at the presidential primary debates have been pretty pointless. According to an analysis of question topics by FAIR intern Gunnar Olson, almost a third of them were unrelated to policy, and some of these were downright silly. What would you want your Secret Service code name to be? Or should the day after the Super Bowl be a national holiday? But on other questions, the media's point was all too clear. The most frequent economic topic was taxes, and questions about social spending often framed it as a vice, as when Fox's Martha McCallum asked, "How do you get Americans who are able to take the job instead of a handout?" On international policy, questioning often took a hawkish tone, as when CNN's Dana Bash challenged Bernie Sanders, "You voted against the Iraq War. You voted against the Gulf War. Under what circumstances would a President Sanders actually use force?" Or when CBS's John Dickerson asked Hillary Clinton if the Paris attacks had made her change her mind about not declaring war against ISIS. The most recent Republican debate, not included in FAIR's study, was focused on terrorism and keeping the country safe. The tone was set by moderator Hugh Hewitt of Salem Media's question for Ben Carson, laying out what Hewitt evidently sees as a primary requisite for a U.S. president. Quote, "Could you order airstrikes that would kill innocent children by not the scores, but the hundreds and the thousands?" Close quote. Well, both the moderators and the candidates were clear about what terrorism and whose safety they were interested in. As Adam Johnson pointed out on FAIR.org, in a debate in which more than 20,000 words were spoken, the words Planned Parenthood or Charleston did not appear. In the course of arguments over the University of Texas's affirmative action plan, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia suggested that African Americans belong in slower track schools. It can be argued, Scalia said, that, quote, "it does not benefit African Americans to get them into the University of Texas, where they do not do well, as opposed to having them go to a slower track school, where they do well," close quote. Admitting fewer black students to U of T wouldn't necessarily be bad, Scalia continued, citing a brief in the case. Quote, "most of the black scientists in this country don't come from schools like the University of Texas. They come from lesser schools where they do not feel that they're being pushed ahead in classes that are too fast for them," close quote. Well, those were remarkable comments, and they were remarked upon. But if you only read the New York Times, you might not quite have seen why. Due to Times Supreme Court reporter Adam Liptak's choice to tweak Scalia's comments in a way that altered their meaning. Wrote Liptak, quote, "In a remark that drew muted gasps in the courtroom, Justice Antonin Scalia said that minority students with inferior academic credentials may be better off at a less advanced school, a slower track school where they do well," close quote. The reason for the gasps, surely, was that Scalia didn't say black students with inferior academic credentials would be better off at worse schools. He said African Americans in general would. The Times and other media should grapple with that head on, not disguise it. And finally, according to the Tyndall Report, Donald Trump accounts for 27% of all nightly broadcast TV campaign coverage so far, more than all the Democratic candidates combined. Tyndall also confirms what even the Christian Science Monitor is calling a virtual blackout of Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders. ABC World News Tonight, which devoted 81 minutes this year to Donald Trump's campaign, gave Sanders about 20 seconds. You can say a lot about that, but you can't justify it with talk about electability, since a Quinnipiac poll from early December found that Sanders would beat Trump by 8 points in a general election. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. In a way, something was lost once media stopped putting the phrase "war on terror" in rhetorical quotation marks. We lost a degree of critical distance on whether an abstraction could be an official enemy and battlefield practices and rationales appropriated to a fight that might happen anywhere against enemies unheard of until the event. As a framework for understanding the violence the U.S. is engaged in around the world, war on terror seems patently flawed, especially when it means war only on something called Islamic extremist terror, a term that itself confuses more than it explains. We are joined now to discuss this by Arun Kundyani. He teaches at NYU and is the author of, most recently, The Muslims Are Coming: Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. Welcome to Counterspin, Arun Kundyani.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a truism that for many media and politicians, a killer who is Muslim is moved to kill by Islam, while one who says black people have to die is a unique individual for whom that belief is part of a complex kaleidoscope of meanings. The reduction of Islam to violence and then the attendant policy ideas are in full bloom, if you will, on the right now, and it's really quite distressing to see. But if we could skip ahead to what might be called the liberal alternative to that vision, to that approach, for example, you've suggested that that vision is problematic in its own way. How so?
Yes, I think we need to pay more attention to the way that we argue with conservatives in this area. So in the last week, for example, we've seen a lot of liberals reject Donald Trump's ban on Muslims on the grounds that to ban Muslims would inflame opinion against us in the Middle East and therefore lead to more terrorism. And so what you're seeing, rather than a kind of principled argument against Trump's racism, what you're seeing instead is a kind of pragmatic argument that says if we just say the wrong thing, then we're going to find that we will generate more terrorism again, which, of course, feeds this kind of underlying assumption that Muslims are these crazy people who are on the verge of becoming terrorists the whole time. You know, we have a kind of way of thinking, I think, coming from Democrat Party liberals and prominent voices in the kind of liberal commentariat that kind of takes this view where you kind of distinguish between the idea of moderate Muslims and the idea of extremist Muslims. And you say there is a problem of extremist Muslims, and we need to understand that is not all Muslims. It's a certain subsection that we have a problem with. And you know, this is the kind of liberal alternative to the conservative idea that, you know, the problem is just Islam is violent. The problem is that you end up still assuming that there's just something about this population that leads to terrorism. And you ignore the fact that terrorism is a political problem. It's not a religious problem. Anyone who pays attention to what has been happening in the Middle East for decades and looks at the whole history here will understand that it's, you know, what we're dealing with is a product of geopolitics. Religious ideology plays a role, but its role is one of giving people a vocabulary for expressing political issues. And it's not the underlying driver. It's not the root cause, which is what both liberals and conservatives tend to assume here.
You've described radicalization as kind of the latest phase of Islamophobia. You know, it in shows like the television program Homeland, for example, it's seen as an advance because it locates terrorism on a psychological level, but it still presents Islam as itself kind of inherently radicalizing, and the question is just whether these people will succumb to it or not, you know. And one of the key points of that, I think, that is so important to keep in mind is that where that vision leads us is to a place where, you know, not all Muslims are bad, yes, of course, but if someone is Muslim and also critical of U.S. policies, then that is seen as adding up to a precursor to terrorism. And that, of course, is a very corrosive idea for politics, for political expression.
Yes, precisely. And so, you know, we did not use this word radicalized or radicalization 20 years ago when we wanted to talk about terrorism. It's now become a part of our everyday vocabulary here in media all the time. How has that happened? Well, it's because terrorism experts, so-called, have been regularly saying that radicalization is the key concept that we need to understand terrorism. What does this concept of radicalization mean? It means a process by which someone goes from being someone who's not a terrorist to being someone who is a terrorist. You just use the language here that captures that, the idea that someone's a precursor to being a terrorist. In other words, they're not a terrorist, but something about them makes us think that they will be at some point in the future. So at the heart of this idea of radicalization, if we're going to use this vocabulary, there is a claim to be able to predict who can be a terrorist, right? No social scientific study has ever been able to achieve that predictive power. And yet the government officials and the media, commentators, we all use this language that assumes that somehow you can tell from someone's non-violent, law-abiding behavior that they're on a pathway to becoming a terrorist. And obviously those indicators that we assume tell us someone's on that pathway are all to do with religious behaviors in some way. So, you know, we have seen from the New York Police Department reports come out that say someone growing a beard, that's an indicator of radicalization. Someone changing the clothing they wear to be what they call traditional Islamic clothing is an indicator of radicalization. So no evidence supports this idea, but this has become part of our way of thinking about terrorism now. We're trying to, every Muslim in America, the question that is hovering over them is there something about you that is displaying the signs of radicalization, that you're about to become a terrorist? That's what we look for now in these cases like in San Bernardino. What were the indicators of radicalization? The truth is, these things are, at the level of an individual, completely unpredictable. And there is no radicalization model that can explain how someone comes to believe that it's okay to kill their fellow citizens.
We talk a little bit, at least, about how the tools of the so-called war on terror are then turned on domestic social movements. We talk about it moving that way. We talk less about how the suppression of social movements itself leads to the rise of terrorist groups and of violent groups. And you have discussed that as being connected to the need to, if I can use your words, the need to defend the spaces of radical politics and the right to dream of another world. It does have something to do with having spaces for us to talk and to share political ideas. That's a critical kind of anti-violence tool, is it not?
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think we desperately need to understand that the root cause of of political violence in any form is political, right? It's not about fanaticism. It's not about religion. It's about politics. And it's about people who feel that the regular day-to-day political processes have absolutely no chance of bringing about any redress for the injustices that they see in the world. So what we need is more radicalization, in fact, in the genuine sense of the word, in the sense of people being able to participate in movements that offer a genuine chance of achieving social progress, a vision of what that would look like. We've been starved of visions of change that are compelling for something like two decades now. And that is really the context in which in Europe, for example, in which ISIS can have some kind of attraction for a tiny number of people, because they're operating in a vacuum. No one else is offering, no one else is speaking the language of utopianism that they speak. Politics has been gentrified and made very bland, particularly for young people in communities of color in Europe. So that's, I think, ultimately where the alternatives arise.
We've been speaking with Arun Kunani. His most recent book is The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. It's out now from Verso. Arun Kunani, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
U.S. elite media spent weeks stoking fears about Venezuelan elections. Not to put too fine a point on it, the Washington Post ran an editorial headed "Venezuela's Dirty Election Approaches," which worried that Nicolas Maduro might, quote, resort to outright fraud or violence to prevent an opposition victory, close quote. But it hasn't required any real gear changing for media to address the major opposition victory in those elections, calling them, as one New York Times story did, a gut blow for the movement known as Chavismo. U.S. media's treatment of Maduro is less florid than that given his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, whose demonization bordered on the comical. But the recent round of coverage still raises questions about media's principles regarding elections and the unspoken things reporters seem to accept about the appropriate role for the U.S. in other countries' politics. Joining us now to discuss these questions is journalist and activist Keen Bhatt. Welcome back to Counterspin, Keen Bhatt.
Pleasure to be with you, Jeanine. Thank you.
Well, I think one way to get into this is by talking about the OAS. We know that the Carter Center has called Venezuela's election process one of the best that they've observed. But in the run-up to the recent election, one of the things cited as evidence of skullduggery was Venezuela's refusal to have the OAS, the Organization of American States, be election observers. Both the New York Times and the Washington Post cited a letter of concern from the OAS as remarkable, given we were to understand that group's usual reluctance to interfere. What do you think was significant in all of that about the OAS?
I think that the State Department, the Washington, D.C.-based think tanks, and also the corporate press all worked almost in coordination with that particular talking point of the OAS being a kind of a litmus test as to whether, you know, Venezuela could truly ensure free and fair elections by permitting the OAS observers to monitor the elections. And that framework relied on a general lack of knowledge about what the OAS is and what its record is. And in order to retain that as an effective talking point, a lot of these different sources did not mention that the OAS is financed, about 60% of its annual budget is financed by the United States. And that when it comes to electoral observation, it actually has a very checkered history, one that creates a lot of suspicion throughout Latin America, and rightly so. In 2010, the OAS actually came in to Haiti and did something unprecedented in electoral history. In the first round of that election, which was marred by massive amounts of fraud, It actually took place on the heels of a massive cholera epidemic. What they ended up doing was taking a third-place finisher, Michel Martelly, who was the favored candidate of the United States, and without initiating a recount, without any kind of statistical basis whatsoever, simply recommended that Michel Martelly go on to the second round of elections, simply swapping him out with another candidate. And as a result of that, the rest of the hemisphere looks with a lot of circumspection towards the OAS. And so when the State Department insists that the OAS, as some kind of a neutral arbiter, as a multilateral organization, be allowed to enter into Venezuela, it's also not recognizing that its Secretary General has behaved so undiplomatically in his 18-page letter attack on Venezuela's electoral system that his former boss, the Uruguayan president, Pepe Mujica, literally disowned him publicly. That was a really important way to delegitimize an electoral system that is actually, as you mentioned, one of the strongest systems for safeguarding both the privacy and the integrity of the vote. They actually have an audit both with paper ballots and through the electronic system that ensures through a 54% audit immediately after the vote is taken that the entirety of votes are counted and are correct. The odds that there was election fraud, which the Venezuelan opposition alleged in the most recent presidential elections, was 1 in 25 quadrillion. That's because of all of the different safeguards that are implemented through that process.
Well, and of course, the media outlets that were so concerned about potential for fraud in the Venezuelan elections are not really talking about the results as being possibly fraudulent, you know, the opposition victory. You know, they are kind of taking that in stride. But I want to move you back to the elections in Haiti, which are, unlike Venezuela, are still kind of ongoing. There has been an editorial response. I think part of what we'd want to say is that there's been a lot less attention to Haiti than to Venezuela in this electoral process. But there's a lot of dispute and a lot of altercations, protests going on in Haiti. And now we're seeing some editorial response in the United States. What do you make of, for example, the New York Times' response to the call for legitimate elections in Haiti?
I strongly praise the New York Times editorial board for taking a stance against the State Department and against the OAS in calling out the most recent round of elections, which took place in October in Haiti, as fraudulent. This was indeed the case, and these elections were financed with $30 million of U.S. money. So at the same time as the United States, through the State Department, through the leading establishment press, and through think tanks, worked themselves up into a frenzy over the supposed failures and systemic flaws of the Venezuelan electoral arena, they were virtually silent on the case of Haiti. This editorial is one exception to that generalized silence, and it should be praised for what it is. Interestingly enough, the New York Times editorial board, I think what this demonstrates is that it is an important kind of a barometer of different kinds of opportunities for civil society within the United States to change the framework for debate. And I think that the New York Times editorial board has become increasingly more independent in its political stances. What is interesting, however, is that the Washington Post editorial, which basically rubber stamped this fraudulent system in Haiti, where 900,000 accreditation passes were given and sold in a black market, which allowed their possessors to be able to vote multiple times at various polling stations, creating a massively incomprehensible vote tally. The Washington Post went ahead and endorsed this. And what was interesting is that a researcher at the Center for Economic and Policy Research uncovered emails from Hillary Clinton, which in a similar instance previously had deployed the Washington Post editorial board as a kind of a counterweight to the New York Times editorial board, basically knowing that the State Department could reliably use its talking points to influence the shape of that editorial board's coverage on Haiti. So this is an interesting dynamic in which, you know, the press plays a very important role in informing people. I think that outside of the United States, where a lot of the population is unencumbered by some of this ideology, they see this dishonest rhetoric that's emanating, where Venezuela is constantly perceived of as this oppressive arena in which there is no dissent and in which there are no fair elections. And the almost total absence of any conversation whatsoever in the case of Haiti, where those very fraudulent elections, which are stacked institutionally in favor of the U.S.'s favored candidates, are being financed and advanced by these multilateral agencies like the OAS and the State Department. I think that that is an indication to the rest of the hemisphere that it needs to seek out alternative multilateral solutions. And that was indeed carried out in Venezuela. So the Union of South American Nations, UNASUR, was present in Venezuela during that election. And I think that what we're going to be seeing is, as a result of the OAS being deployed as a political instrument by the United States, UNASUR and other entities like the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States are going to displace the OAS and other U.S.-dominated multilateral institutions in being the primary venues for addressing hemispheric affairs. And that can only be seen as a positive.
We've been speaking with Keen Bott. You can read his article, A Tale of Two Elections in Jacobin, at jacobinmag.com. Keen Bott, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you'd like more information about FAIR, you can check out our website. It's fair.org. The website is also the place to join our Action Alert Network or to show support for FAIR if you are so inclined. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Dramatic footage is coming out of Norway, where there's heavy flooding after a storm in the country's southwest. Record downpours have caused extensive damage in what's being described as the worst flooding in 200 years.
The skies above Cumbria have cleared, but the legacy of Storm Desmond lives on. I'm above the city of Carlisle, and the sheer scale and depth of the floods is extraordinary. This isn't only affecting the people who live here, it's having a huge impact on transport. The major rail link through here has been cut. And this is a place, bear in mind, that was just given 5 years ago a new £38 million flood defence scheme.
The violence and the volume of the floodwater have taken everyone by surprise.
It's particularly devastating because it's the third time in a very short period of time this has happened. It's really dreadfully, dreadfully upsetting.
David Shookman, BBC News in Cumbria.
The heaviest rains in over a century, sending a wave of floods across southern India. At least 180 people have died in the disaster in the state of Tamil Nadu. More than 200,000 people have fled from their homes. In the capital city, Chennai, thousands of factories are shut down. The power is cut, schools are closed, and the airport is paralyzed. India grapples with monsoon flooding every year. But Reuters' Douglas Busfind says Prime Minister Narendra Modi has blamed this particular crisis on global warming.
That was a remark he made on returning from the climate summit in Paris. And it's certainly the case that the Indian government has recognized that climate change is a challenge to its own management of cities, its own ability to respond to disasters. This is definitely on the government's agenda.
More than twice as much rain has fallen on Tamil Nadu in the last 24 hours as the entire December average. Weather forecasters say the downpour is set to continue for at least another day.
Evacuations ongoing as rising rivers and creeks forced people out of their homes in Portland this morning. Monday was the wettest day in Portland ever, leading to rescues and washed out roads. Don Champion has the latest.
Extreme rainfall events are cropping up around the world. In England, once-in-a-thousand-year floods have repeated. I think it's three times now in 5 years. Records are falling in many countries. In a warmer world, we've gained 7% more water vapor in the atmosphere. It has to come down somewhere. A few weeks ago, our guest David Wasdell suggested the outcome of our current path of emissions would eventually be a world at least 8 degrees centigrade hotter on average, maybe more. Some questioned that. This week, the University of Edinburgh released a paper echoing Wasdell's climate. 8 degrees is possible, according to Professor Roy Thompson, as published in the Transactions of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. Climate change does not occur in a steady economy or a peaceful time. This fall, we saw in Paris how terrorism empowered politicians to ban climate action in the name of public safety. The terrorists knew they were attacking before the world flooded in for the COP21 climate talks. They succeeded in disrupting the essential public voice. But in this show, we asked two different questions. Will the fossil-based economy collapse, just as extreme weather events punish property and infrastructure? What if we are too broke to rebuild or cope? There's a blog for that. It's the Economic Collapse blog with millions of readers. We'll look at fresh warnings of a new depression, how it's forming, with blogger Michael T. Snyder. Then, believe it or not, there are darker things to consider. If climate disrupts agriculture as expected and already happening, social violence and wars may become worse. Our guest, Professor Tim Snyder, explains why climate change may open the door to more mass murder. It needs to be said, and he said it in the New York Times. We'll talk with Tim Snyder. Off we go now with the black clouds hanging over economies around the world. Since the financial crash of 2007-2008, we've all been a bit nervous about our jobs and the economy. Lately, the warning signs are flashing again, despite trillions of dollars, euros, and pounds given to the banks. Maybe the system is just plain bankrupt and ready to collapse. Blogger Michael T. Snyder runs a blog called The Economic Collapse. It's hugely popular. His warning signs are spread around the internet. Michael is young, a professed Christian, now a novelist, and too often scarily ahead of the mainstream news. Michael, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. Thank you so much for inviting me to be on today.
I check your blog about twice a week. Do you know how many readers you have?
I do. The Economic Collapse blog has been running since 2009, and at this point, we average well over a million page views per month, month after month after month. Yeah, it's really exciting that so many people from all over the world come and visit the website. But then, of course, as you mentioned, my articles are republished on dozens of other websites all over the world, some much more prominent than my own, where they're seen countless more times each month. So it absolutely amazes me that someone just as myself, an ordinary guy living in the middle of nowhere in the mountains of Idaho, can literally impact people all over the world.
Yeah, I have read several of your articles on Zero Hedge, one of the biggest financial blogs there is, so you definitely are getting out there. Michael, when did you realize the financial system was unstable? And I guess you've told us when you started the Economic Collapse blog. It's been a few years now.
It has been. You know, some of your listeners may not be familiar with me, but I was actually once an attorney. I went to law school at the University of Florida Law School down in Gainesville, Florida, and I graduated from there with a law degree and an LLM. And once I left there, I went back to my old stomping grounds up in the D.C. area, and I actually worked as an attorney right in the heart of Washington, D.C. for a number of years. And so I was working there for quite some time, right down on K Street, kind of where, you know, if you watch television shows or movies about Washington, D.C., you know, K Street's where all the lawyers are, where all the lobbyists are. It doesn't necessarily have the greatest reputation in the world, but I was there. I was just another of the mindless drones that march into Washington, D.C. every day, trying to make a living, trying to make a paycheck. And so that's what I was doing. But at the time, I was becoming increasingly distressed about the direction of our country, about the corruption I saw all around me, about our economic situation. And so the 2008 crash approached. I warned family and friends. In fact, I remember sitting on the sofa when we went up to visit my wife's parents up in Canada and sitting there and sitting on their sofa and telling them in the summer of 2008, a great financial crash was imminent. And, of course, we all know what happened later that year. And so, you know, I was very, very disturbed about that. But it wasn't until late 2009, end of 2009, about this time of the year, that I started the Economic Collapse blog. And it really took off because people at the time, millions of people have been losing their jobs. Millions of people have been losing their homes. And people were confused because they knew they weren't getting the truth from the mainstream media. They didn't understand what was happening to them, and they were looking for real answers. And so websites such as mine have really taken off. And ever since then, the audience has continued to grow. And like I said, today we've got a very, very large audience, and I'm very thankful for that.
For a while there recently, the whole media choir was singing about the recovery. And you seemed like the odd man out, but now I've read on your blog and elsewhere, major banks and billionaires admit we are perched on the edge of another downturn. Who are some of the big-name institutions or well-known business icons who are now warning us?
Yeah, well, just the other day, first of all, J.P. Morgan Chase came out, and they issued a report which said that the possibility of a recession within the next 3 years is 76%, the probability of recession within the next 3 years. But Citigroup was even more pessimistic than J.P. Morgan Chase. Researchers at Citigroup recently released a report where they declared there was a 65% chance that the U.S. economy will plunge into recession by the end of next year, in 2016.
All right. Now, Michael, you're kind of famous for your lists of signs that things are about to fall apart. Could you read us one of your top 10 warning lists?
Yeah, and this one will kind of go along with what I was just talking about, in that right now so many of the exact same patterns and signs that we witnessed right before the great crash of 2008 are happening again right in front of our eyes. For example, global GDP growth has gone negative for the first time since 2009, the last financial crisis. Corporate earnings growth has turned negative. That's something we saw right before the last financial crisis. S&P 500 net profit margins are steeply declining. And why is that important? Well, since 1973, there has only been one 60 basis point decline in S&P 500 net profit margins that didn't lead to a recession. So this is a leading indicator. This is something we tend to watch for, something that would happen before a recession. You know, something else we expect to see before recession is for global trade to, for a big downturn in global trade. This is something that happened before the last crisis. It's happening now. The biggest bank in the Western world, HSBC, recently came out and said global trade as a whole on a dollarized basis is down 8.4% for the whole world for the year so far. And then we just learned that in October, U.S. imports of goods declined by 6.6% on a year-over-year basis. Kind of surprising because this time of the year, normally we're importing all kinds of stuff to fill up our stores for the busy holiday season, but our imports are down 6.6% for the month of October. Then our exports are down even more. And if you remember Barack Obama, he came out and he said, I'm going to increase U.S. exports. It's going to create more jobs for American workers, blah, blah, blah. But instead, exports are declining. In October, U.S. exports of goods were down 10.4% on a year-over-year basis. These are exactly what we would expect to see before a recession or as we're entering a recession. Also look at manufacturing. U.S. manufacturing is contracting at the fastest pace that we have seen since the last recession. Corporate debt defaults have risen to the highest level that we've seen since the last recession. We've got all this corporate debt going bad. Corporations getting into trouble. They can't pay their debts. They can't service their debts. Huge problem. This is something that we also saw the last time around. Also, you know, as we entered the last crisis, holiday sales went negative. Well, for the very first time since the last recession, credit card numbers show that holiday sales have gone negative. You know, we've read all this information about potentially a weak holiday season as consumers are stressed. Consumers don't have the same kind of money to spend. That's another problem. And so all these things are adding up. Another thing that I watch that I'm concerned about is the velocity of money, and perhaps I should explain that for a moment. When an economy is working efficiently, when times are good, when people are feeling good about things, money tends to flow through the system pretty easily and smoothly. So I buy something from you, you buy something from someone else. The velocity of money tends to go pretty well. But when things start getting hard, when people don't have money, when credit's not flowing smoothly, when people get fearful, they tend to start holding on to their money, the velocity of money slows down. And so what we've seen during every single recession in the post-World War II era, the velocity of money has dropped, and that makes perfect sense for all the reasons why I just explained. Well, a funny thing happened with the last recession. During the last recession, 2008-2009, the velocity of money dropped dramatically, exactly what we would expect. Then the recession ended, and the velocity of money ticked up just slightly, but then it started going down again, and it kept going down and down and down all throughout the supposed economic recovery, and just recently it dropped to the lowest level ever recorded. And so that's an indication of an economy that is very, very deeply troubled. And, of course, this is not just a U.S. thing. We're seeing globally what we're seeing, some very troubling signs. We're seeing the price of oil. If you remember, right before the stock market crash of 2008, we saw the price of oil go up to about $140 a barrel, drop dramatically to beneath $40 a barrel. It was the biggest oil crash in all of history. Well, we've seen a similar thing happen here in just in recent times. In late 2014, the price of oil really crashed. It had been over $100 a barrel at one point, crashed dramatically, but then it stabilized for a little while. But now it's crashing again, and just this week it fell below $38 a barrel for the very first time since 2009, since the last the financial crisis and the last recession. You know, also looking at commodities. Before the great financial crash of 2008, we saw a crash in the price of commodities. I'm talking about things like iron ore, copper, lead, tin, aluminum, things of that nature. Well, right now we're seeing the price of commodities crash again. In fact, the Bloomberg Commodity Index just hit a 16-year low. This is exactly what we would expect to see if a major financial crash was imminent. Another thing I watch very, very closely is junk bonds. You know, when there's financial trouble, usually we start to see it play out in at the edges. Kind of, you know, junk bonds, a lot of people may get thrown off by that term, but it's just junk bonds are considered to be a little bit riskier, so they have a higher rate of return. And therefore, corporations that are maybe not as stable, a little bit riskier, well, that's where we start to see the trouble erupt when financial trouble starts to come. And so in 2008, junk bonds crashed before stocks did. And if it was going to happen again, we would expect to see it start to happen again. Well, a high-yield bond ETF that I watch very, very closely, known as JNK, I've been waiting for it to hit the psychologically important 35 level and drop below that. And it hasn't happened since 2009, but it happened just this week. Just this week, JNK hit 35, went below 35, dropped down to 34.44 at one point. But that's a huge red flag that big trouble is coming for stocks. And then on top of everything else, back in 2008, we started to see other global stock markets start to collapse before U.S. stocks did. And right now, in 2015, of the 93 largest stock market indexes in the entire world, 47 of them, slightly more than half, are not only just down, but 47 of them have plunged at least 10% year-to-date. Some of them down like 40 or 50%. So already we've seen global stock market crashes all over the world. It's just the U.S. hasn't felt the full force of this yet. And so, you know, Americans are saying, well, maybe everything's going to be okay. But everything that we're seeing is playing out just like we saw in 2008. And everything that we would expect to see right before a major financial crash here in the United States, it's playing out in textbook fashion, Alex.
Yeah, we really have to look in other places of the world, too. We're not just an island in North America or Europe. I'm thinking about Brazil. That was touted as being one of the big powerhouses, the new industrial thing. They had their energy going. Goldman Sachs just came out this month and said they're in an outright depression. There's no way to hide it. Argentina's a mess. We could go on. And many places of the world, they're already in their recession, if not depression, wouldn't you say?
Oh, I completely agree. This is something I started writing back in the summer. And then, like, as you mentioned, when Goldman Sachs came out and said, well, you know, Brazil's really, you know, you might as well call it a depression, what's happening down there. And it's true. They plunged into this horrible recession. They're, if I recall correctly, the sixth largest economy on the entire planet. So Brazil's a really big deal. But what happened was Brazil's considered to be one of these emerging markets. And something we saw before the 2008 crisis was the U.S. dollar surged, and this created all kinds of problems in emerging markets, and it's happening again. And why the U.S. dollar surging is such a big problem was during the quantitative easing era, during the easy money, when the Federal Reserve was creating all this easy money and money was flowing at super low interest rates all over the world, a lot of this hot money flowed into emerging markets. So we saw this huge binge by governments in emerging markets, big corporations in emerging markets. They gorged on debt. Much of it was denominated in U.S. dollars. And so now that the U.S. dollar has really surged in recent months, this is really hurting them because it takes much more of their own local currencies to service and pay back these debts. Meanwhile, the oil and other commodities that they export, they're getting less dollars for, less money for. So it's this double whammy, which is really hitting emerging markets like Brazil really hard. So, you know, Brazil's already in recession. Some are calling it depression. Canada is in recession. Russia's in recession. Japan is in recession. And all over the world, we're seeing recessions in emerging markets. We're seeing stock market collapses in emerging markets. Huge problems all over the planet. But, you know, as Americans, we're so focused on this country, we don't realize the intensity of the carnage that we're already seeing all over the world.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Michael T. Snyder, owner of the Economic Collapse blog. Okay, so do you think, Michael, that we'll wake up one day to find the stock market on the floor and the banks closed? Or will the economy fall apart bit by bit over time?
Well, I've always said that I have a little bit of a different perspective on this, that I believe our economic collapse is something that has been happening, is happening right now, and is going to continue to happen and will accelerate in the future. And yes, there will be big events, but a lot of people who write about the economic collapse, they kind of write about it like it's some big hyped-up event that will happen in a day or a week or a month, and then it'll be over, and then we'll pick up the pieces. Well, I don't see it that way. I see it as a crisis which is ongoing and is going to intensify. So, yeah, I do believe that we're going to see a dramatic stock market crash like we saw in 2008, and that there will be ups and downs, but that, you know, that our financial markets are going to really fall, and they're not going to get back up. You know, although there'll be moments of hope and, you know, moments when things seem like they're getting better, but we are going to see a complete and total kind of final implosion of our current financial system, I believe. And I believe that we will see banks fail, financial institutions fail, two big fail banks actually fail. And, of course, last time around in 2008, we were told, oh, too big to fail, it's a huge problem. Our politicians said, we're going to fix this. Well, did they fix it? Of course not. In fact, since that time, the last crisis, the two big to fail banks, I'm talking about banks like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, Citigroup, et cetera, since the last financial crisis, collectively, the two big to fail banks have gotten 40% larger. Meanwhile, 1,400 smaller banks have totally gone out of existence. So the problem of too big to fail is now bigger than ever. And during this time, instead of learning their lesson, these too big to fail banks have become even more reckless, even more insane. You know, if you want to talk about these derivatives, where five of these too big to fail banks have exposure to derivatives, that's in the tens of trillions of dollars. And yet the biggest one of them, J.P. Morgan Chase, has assets of about $2.6 trillion. And so, you know, these big banks have turned Wall Street into the biggest casino in the history of the world. They've been insanely reckless. Maybe they're counting on the fact that the U.S. government will somehow bail them out, you know, once things spiral out of control. But globally, this derivatives bubble is somewhere in the neighborhood of $600 trillion, according to the Bank for International Settlements. And so when this worldwide derivatives bubble finally bursts, there's not going to be enough money in the entire world to clean up this mess.
I know that you've seen this too. Some bloggers seem to take joy in things falling apart, and they tell us to buy lots of guns to shoot one another, maybe over the last can of food. I don't find that in your work. In fact, you tell us we need more love. How do you get to that space reporting the awful things that you do?
Yeah. You know, a lot of people say, well, Michael, you write about some really hard things. You must be just real negative, depressed person all the time. But that's not true at all. In fact, my wife and I seek to live in a constant state of shalom, which is the Hebrew word for peace. You know, so we don't live in fear. In fact, I sleep extremely good at night. But I don't think it does any good for us to stick our heads in the sand and ignore the problems that are happening, what's happening on the horizon. So I do believe that we are coming up on the worst times. By the time everything is said and done, I believe we're going to see the worst times that America has ever seen, even greater than the Great Depression of the 1930s, any other time you want to name. I believe that by the time we get to the end of the road, and it's going to take a while to get there, by the time everything plays out, things are going to be really bad. So I do advocate preparation. I mean, you know, my wife and I ourselves, we store up food and supplies, and we believe in precious metals and all that. But on the other hand, I also believe that when times are the darkest, that's when the greatest heroes are needed. And if you look back through history and people that we admire, who are the great heroes that we admire? Well, they rose up during times of great challenge, of great stress, of great crisis. So my wife and I are actually looking forward to the future. We believe that the greatest chapters of our lives are still ahead. Yeah, conditions are going to be different from what they are today. Our world is becoming increasingly unstable. Things are going to change. Our lifestyles are going to change. And yet the greatest opportunities to do good, to make a difference, to, you know, do things that are meaningful and purposeful are ahead of us. So we are really excited about what's coming up. But, yeah, things are going to be very, very different in this country, without a doubt.
I know you've published a novel called The Beginning of the End. What are you trying to do with that book?
Well, what I wanted to do was paint a picture, because so many people, you know, they learn about some of these things, and they're like, about what's happening, and they're like, okay, what is my life going to look like? What are we facing? What are we going to be dealing with? And then on the other hand, people really like to be entertained. In our society today, we're addicted to entertainment. The average American watches 293 minutes of television a day. We love our movies, our DVDs, our video games, all the rest of it. You know, so people love a good story. So what I wanted to do was create a compelling and very entertaining story, and that's what this is, The Beginning of the End. It's a mystery slash thriller set in the near future in America. And it's got there's a ex-CIA agent in there, there's a prepper in there, there's a female news reporter, and all their lives end up intersecting in some very interesting ways. And so it's a very interesting story. Some people that have read it said, I got the book, I read it in 48 hours, I couldn't put it down. And so people really enjoy it, but it's a book with a purpose. So what I've done in every chapter, I've tried to incorporate truth bombs. I've tried to communicate so much of what I've learned in my research over the years and really try to paint a picture of what I believe is coming to this country, what things are going to look like as the economy collapses, and so many of the other things I believe are coming, I try to incorporate into this work. So people are being entertained, but at the same time, they're being informed. And it's the kind of thing you can give to a friend, a family member, a coworker, and say, hey, read, you know, check out this great book. But it can also serve to wake them up at the same time.
You know, I worry about how little prepared, even mentally, my fellow citizens seem to be. It's like people want to party right up to the moment the car goes off the cliff. Michael, what do you think softens us up? Is it the media? Is it corrupt government? To big corporations? What makes us so blind to the events that you are reporting every week in the Economic Collapse blog?
Well, that's a really great question, Alex, and you're right, people are prepared. In fact, we haven't learned our lesson from the last time around. About 62% of all Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, and most people seem to think happy days are ahead of us. Well, I think kind of what I touched on earlier, where it really is this giant propaganda matrix that we're all plugged into, that we all greatly underestimate the impact that it has on all of our lives. And so, as I mentioned just earlier, the average American according to the Washington Post, the average American watches 293 minutes of television a day. That's almost 5 hours. And another study found when you add everything together, television and movies and DVDs and the radio and, you know, our smartphones and, you know, video games and everything else, the average American is plugged into some form of media for an average of 10 hours a day. And now, who controls all that? Who's giving us the messages we're constantly getting through all this? Well, at the very top, all of this media, more than 90% of it, is controlled by just 6 gigantic media corporations, which in turn, of course, are owned by the elite of the world. And so they really do set the agenda for what we think about, what we talk about with our family members at the dinner table, at school, at work, around the water cooler, our interactions with each other. So much of what they're based on is a sporting event we just saw, or a television show that we saw, you know, were watching last night, or something that came up on the news. You know, we talk about the things that were fed through this propaganda matrix, and they really set the agenda for what we think about, what we consider to be important. If the mainstream media is not talking about it, totally ignoring it, well, then it must not be meaningful. It must not be important. So one of the things I really try to get people to do is wake up and understand that this gigantic behemoth, which is called the mainstream media, or I call it the propaganda matrix, it has a gigantic amount of impact over all of our lives.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. The other concern I have, Michael Snyder, is coming from the weekly content of my own radio show, we're facing big problems. You can call it whatever you want, but the weather's weird. It's distorted. As we speak, there's been hardly any snow in the northern states, at least in the east. Parts of the south and west coast are drowning in extreme rainfall events. There's droughts, floods around the world. If that keeps going, and governments and just plain people will go broke trying to rebuild over and over. And if your blog is right and the system goes bankrupt first, we won't be able to fix anything. What are your thoughts?
Oh, I agree. You know, we're having huge problems with our infrastructure. You know, up in the state of Michigan, they've actually, some rural roads have actually been, they used to be paved roads, but they've transitioned those back to gravel roads because they're cheaper to maintain, because there's not enough money to maintain our infrastructure. You know, different reports that come out kind of on a yearly basis give extremely low grades to our infrastructure. We're seeing bridges fail all over the country. We've got a huge crisis with our bridges, but it's our roads, it's our airports, it's, you know, our sewer systems are aging and are breaking down, you know, and the money simply isn't there to maintain them and keep them up as they should. So we're seeing infrastructure all over the country break down. At the same time, we're seeing increasing natural disasters. We're seeing in Oklahoma, they've already set a brand new record for the number of earthquakes in a year in Oklahoma, in the central part of the country. You know, we're seeing flooding, you know, right now out in Portland, horrible flooding, rains coming in. Someone just sent me an email today about the flooding out there. Of course, we had the flooding out in South Carolina earlier this year associated with Hurricane Joaquin. The governor of the state said that was a 1,000-year storm. That, you know, the areas of her state got the amount of rain not seen in 1,000 years. Out in California, the drought has been so bad, but then a huge storm came in, caused tremendous flooding and mudslides. Mud came across major highways, you know, and then down in Texas, they've also had horrible flooding, you know, the remnants of Hurricane Patricia down there. So we had all the flooding and then the fires, you know, according to the National Interagency Fire Center, according to them, we have now set a brand new record for the number of acres burned by fire for a year. In any year in U.S. history, this was the worst year for the number of acres burned by wildfires in all of U.S. history. And I know it was really bad because a fire came to within about 10 miles of my home out here in the mountains of Idaho. And so, yeah, we're seeing these natural disasters, all these things increase and become destructive. And then, you know, we're really struggling to rebuild. You know, down in New Orleans, they're still struggling to rebuild, you know, almost a decade after Hurricane Katrina. So it is a major problem, and as the economy gets worse and as government funding dries up a lot more than it is now, this trend and what we're seeing is only going to intensify.
So, Michael Snyder, are we just spectators to a great unwinding that has to happen, or should we fight trying to save the system?
Well, for years, I've been advocating for things that we could do. You know, we needed to do something about Wall Street. We needed to do something about derivatives. We needed to do something about the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is really at the core of our debt-based financial system, which is and central banking all over the world, of course, causing huge, huge problems. And we're seeing global debt at records we've never seen before. You know, something should have been done. Our system should have been fundamentally reformed after the last crisis. We should have learned our lessons. And so there were things that myself and other people were advocating as potential solutions, but they were totally ignored. Instead, the powers that be patched the system together. They went on with business as usual. Our long-term problems continue to get even worse. So at this point, we're so close, and I believe the next crisis has already started. It's unfolding. So I don't believe it's going to be averted. I don't believe there's any hope for a political solution. That doesn't mean we shouldn't advocate for things that can be done, for solutions, for things that can make things better. But, you know, at this point, I am encouraging people to prepare on a community, a family, an individual level, because I do not believe there's any hope in the short term of things being fixed, of things turning around. That doesn't mean we should stop advocating for solutions, but, you know, I'm just trying to be very, very realistic about what we're facing.
Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time. I could talk to you for hours about this. It's so fascinating. For people who want more, could you tell us about the blogs, where your work appears, and any other contact info you want to pass along?
Yeah. People want to follow what I've been talking about, the economy today. The primary website I'm known for is the Economic Collapse blog. You can find that at theeconomiccollapseblog.com, or if you just go to Google and type in the economic collapse, the first result that comes up. I also write articles for a website that I own known as endoftheamericandream.com. And then if you want to find all my articles in a central location, I've got a website which I'm now starting to promote. It's themostimportantnews.com, or if you just go to Google and type in the most important news, it should be the first result that comes up. And then my books, The Beginning of the End, which we talked about earlier, my novel, and then a nonfiction book that I co-authored entitled Get Prepared Now. Both of those can be found on Amazon.com.
Michael Snyder, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Alex. I definitely enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting. Based on science, we can foresee tremendous stress in a future of extreme weather, rising seas, and climate disruption. It could hurt food production and displace hundreds of millions of people. Will we rise to these challenges as a human species? Dr. Timothy D. Snyder suggests much darker possibilities. Dr. Snyder is an American historian, a professor at Yale University, and affiliated with other European institutions. Two of his five books, Black Earth and Bloodlands, have rewritten our understanding of the mass killings by Germany and the Soviet Union during the 1930s and 40s. In a New York Times op-ed, September 13, 2015, Snyder raised a new alarm saying, quote, climate change threatens to provoke a new ecological panic, end quote. Is mass murder in our past or in our future? Dr. Snyder, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, given the subject matter, I've been looking forward to our talk and yet not looking forward to it. And before we get to the environmental parallels in our current world, could we look through some of the research you've done to say, well, for example, that many more millions of civilians died outside of death camps than in them? Why didn't we know that?
Right. So the book that I discuss that in is called Bloodlands. And in Bloodlands, what I try to do is move us away from the traditional ways that we minimize mass killing. We tend to either start from some nation or other that we're particularly interested in, or we criticize one political system that we don't like, let's say the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany. What I did instead of that was to move away from the national and the ideological and try to return to the territorial and the human. And I began from a really simple observation, which is that the huge majority of the deliberate political mass killing that takes place in Europe in the 20th century takes place at a very short period of time in a relatively confined bit of territory between Berlin and Moscow between 1933 and 1945. Why do we not know this? We don't know this because we see things ideologically, we see things nationally, but also because that's a part of the world. It's precisely that part of the world which was behind the Iron Curtain through 1989. So researching things that we think we know about, like, for example, the Holocaust, actually requires us to look eastward. Just to take the Holocaust as the most familiar of these crimes, the entirety of the Holocaust takes place in this zone. Basically, every single Jew who's killed in the Holocaust is killed in Eastern Europe and not in the places that are more familiar to us.
So what rationale did Hitler and his cronies have for their invasion of Poland and the Ukraine?
Well, Hitler wanted war. The fundamental goal of Hitler's rise to power was to start a war. He wanted a war because he believed that the world was corrupt, that the present state of affairs did not reflect nature, that nature demanded of everyone racial struggle, and that in particular Germans are unfairly confined in Central Europe and should have an empire which befits their status as a higher race. So the strategy, such as it was to destroy the Soviet Union and to take Ukraine, because Ukraine was believed to be correctly a source of fertile soil and thereby food and thereby political and economic independence and grandeur for Germany. Now, along the way, Hitler has to do a whole bunch of things which he hadn't really planned on. He didn't expect that he would have to fight a war against Poland or, for that matter, against Britain. He didn't know that Czechoslovakia could be so easily dismantled. So between 1938 and 1941, when the main war against the Soviet Union starts, we see a whole suite of destructive events in which the European order is essentially destroyed. Austria goes away, Czechoslovakia goes away, Poland is invaded in 1939, all in order to pave the way for the invasion of the Soviet Union. But over the course of those years, as states are destroyed, new forms of political anarchy are created which allow the SS, the Nazis, to figure out how a final solution can actually be implemented, and that is by way of mass murder.
So in a minute, we'll get back to your major warning about what people will do to protect their lifestyles. But first, I want to say I spent a few years reading about the Holocaust and the Hitler regime, and it was disturbing to realize that some aspects of National Socialist policy would be considered green, trying to restore nature. And although Greens are aligned with the left today, a green fascism is not impossible. Would you agree?
Well, what Hitler thinks about nature, I think, is crucial. I wouldn't want to speak for the Greens today, but I think it's probably fair as a general matter to say that they don't see nature as a kind of naked zone of natural resources to be exploited remorselessly by whichever people appoint themselves as the higher race. That's how Hitler saw nature. And by restoring nature, what he meant was restoring what he thought of as a state of nature in which people murdered each other by starvation continuously for no other reason except to exploit natural resources. So that's his idea of nature. And a lot hangs on what you think nature actually is. And I would say that most environmentalists probably see nature in a rather different way.
Well, that's a long conversation because I know Martin Heidegger, the Nazi philosopher, or at least he was for a while, said, for example, rivers have a right to exist for their own sakes and should not be dammed. And I know there are some American environmentalists who would agree with that. But that's not really why we're talking today. I mean, one of the great mass murders of recent times developed, as you say, in African Rwanda in 1994. We were told it was a tribal battle between the Hutus and the Tutsis. Was there an ecological side as well?
Of course there was. It's very rare to find an episode of mass killing in which there's not some ecological concern. We find it easier to decode the politics and the ideas. And in our own lives, what separates us from the Germans is that we Americans at least, Canadians, British, Australians, don't face day-to-day the kind of ecological uncertainties that even Europeans did back in the 1930s. It's that which blinds us to the economic side of atrocity, to the ecological side of atrocity. So anyone who studies Rwanda would know that the year before the mass killing began, there was an absolute decline in crop yields, which is an unusual event. And one would also want to know that there was a general belief inside Rwanda that land was short, that fertile land was in short supply, and that the civil war that was underway was largely about control of land. And then during the course of the mass murder, the people who murdered almost always took land, and people from one tribe would even kill people from their own tribe in order to get land. This, by the way, is very similar to the elements of the history of the Holocaust and other European ethnic cleansings and mass murders that we tend to forget, namely that it's always the case that a tremendous amount of real estate changes hands, either by the people who do the killing or by people who benefit from the killing and thereby are, in a general way, implicated in what happens. And so this can be something trivial, like people in Vienna in 1938 wanting bigger apartments, or it can be something more palpable, like Africans who are actually concerned about having enough food to survive. But either way, the sense of improving one's own fate can lead to be one of the sources of mass killing.
But would we kill each other just for lifestyle if we had enough food?
Well, I think, you know, the history of the post-war United States or the Western world generally demonstrates that it is possible to give people a sense of satisfaction. It's just extremely hard. And Hitlerian politics warn us that it doesn't have to be about actual starvation. What Hitler meant by Lebensraum, by living space, was not just controlling enough territory to survive. He mobilized survivalist emotions by talking that way. But what he really meant was that Germans had the right to have the highest standard of living in the world. They had the right to feel that they weren't falling behind, for example, the Americans. He put it explicitly that way. And I worry a bit that Hitler was on to something when he defined lifestyle as always being relative and always being subjective, that there's a lot to be said for the worry that Americans or others would behave badly, not because their lives were necessarily threatened, but because their styles of life were threatened.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Yale History Professor Tim Snyder. We're talking about the possibility of mass murder in the coming time of climate disruption. You write about several hotspots where mass murder might develop as a new final solution. I'd like to add one, and that's the border where Muslim Bangladesh meets Hindu-dominated India. We may be only decades away, Tim, from a tipping point where repeated incursions of rising seas drive millions of people out of Bangladesh towards where? An already population-soaked India. Do you see that as a possible flashpoint for millions of deaths?
I don't know about millions of deaths, but certainly you're right. And a number of other people have drawn attention to that, precisely that scenario. I decided in the conclusion to simplify things by concentrating on desertification scenarios like Libya, where the annual drought is expected to increase from 100 days to 200 days, to Egypt, where the Nile could very well go dry, right, in sometime in the foreseeable future, to Syria and Iraq, where the Fertile Crescent no longer exists, where ISIS fights from waterhole to waterhole. I decided for simplicity's sake to focus on those kinds of scenarios, but you're exactly right. As one moves into South Asia, Central Asia, East Asia, one also has scenarios which involve too much water and people having to move for that reason.
Tim Snyder, your New York Times article suggests China may be forced to adopt some of the same arguments that Hitler did. It's possible. Please take as long as you need to explain that scenario for us.
So let me take two steps before I answer that question. The first step is to repeat that these kinds of arguments are not necessarily about the Chinese or about the Germans or about the Americans. They have to do with modern politics. So if I say that China has a Lebensraum problem, I'm not saying that the Chinese leadership is necessarily like the Nazis or that the Chinese are prone to this kind of behavior any more than anyone else. What I would be saying is that China, in the early part of the 21st century, faces a situation which is rather similar to that of Germany in the early 20th. Namely, you have a big, prosperous, developing, exporting economy, which cannot guarantee itself from its own land a reliable supply of food, and therefore is anxious, always anxious, about international markets. The second step I would want to take before pointing to the risk is to try to draw a distinction between local episodes of genocide and the kinds of international episodes which would be the greatest danger. We've already mentioned South Asia, the Middle East, Syria, Africa, places where episodes of ethnic cleansing and genocide have taken place in the last quarter century or so. Now, horrible as all these events are, they involve state failure and ecological panic, two of the factors that I highlight in the book. The truly horrifying scenario, the worst of all possible scenarios, one which would be much more similar to the 1930s and 40s, would be when a state with state capacity, with the ability to think ahead, adopt some ideology about how other people are to blame for ecological problems and destroys other states. That is, you see, what actually happened in the Holocaust. The Holocaust was not a matter of the German state becoming authoritarian and killing its own citizens. It killed almost no Jews on the territory of pre-war Germany before the war. What the Holocaust was an artificially generated resource war, which had the consequence of destroying other people's states, creating a political vacuum in which an ideology of anti-Semitism could actually lead to mass murder. So what we have to worry about in the future, most of all, is that some powerful state which can think ahead destroys neighboring or distant political structures based in some kind of ideology about how this is right. So the Chinese scenario depends upon a lot of historical thinking, as well as a lot of, you know, attempts to understand the Chinese point of view, which is a bit different from ours in terms of resources. And the particular things that I'm worried about are existing Chinese investments, leases, attempts to control land in East Africa, as well as Chinese possible moves in the future towards northwards towards Siberia.
Now, in the United States, in the Republican-controlled Congress, climate denial is rampant. How does that compare to Hitler's opposition to science?
Well, I got to say, in general, I think this is not going to be a moment on which we look back with pride. I wouldn't want to say that, you know, these people are like National Socialists in every respect. That would be completely ludicrous. All I'm saying is that if we read the sources, if we read the history, we notice things about the origins of the Holocaust that make us uncomfortable and should make us uncomfortable. The problem with the way we think about the Holocaust now is that we only talk about it when it already aligns with our existing worldviews, right? So American Republicans would generally say the Holocaust was the result of a German authoritarian state, which arose because there was too much social democracy and a too big welfare state and so on and so forth, which is total nonsense. It's historically completely nonsense. The thing that we might want to pay attention to in the present moment is the way that Hitler, in his own writings and practice, brought science and politics together. What Hitler said was, we must compete now. We must struggle now. We must fight now because science cannot save us. He specifically denied that science could create a more bountiful future for the Germans, for the Europeans, for everyone. He specifically denied the relevant technologies of his day, which were the hybridization of grains, irrigation, pesticides, fertilizers, because he needed to claim that all there was conflict. So this is not just like today, but it certainly casts some light on a mistake that we can make today. We make a similar mistake today if we say that climate science isn't real, alternative energy isn't real, because in doing that, we make a mistake in principle and a mistake in practice. The mistake in principle is to say that science is politics and politics is science, to say that the scientists are just one more lobby, it's just one more opinion, you know, they're paid by somebody, why should we believe them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is a Hitlerian move, because what it does is it removes the possibility for hope in the future. If there is hope for the future, then there's no need for conflict now. The practical mistake is, if you don't support science, then you in fact are co-creating a world in which actual resource conflicts are not only more likely, they're going to come much faster. And in that world, the danger of all kinds of conflict, including bloody conflict, which would be called genocide or ethnic cleansing, is much more likely. So we need the reality of science, but we also need hope, because as the years pass, we're all going to see, as most of us already feel, the consequences of climate change. And as that gets worse, it's very important for us to think that there is something that we can do besides take other people's land. And there is something. The question is whether we believe in it and invest in it sufficiently in time.
Isn't there a large difference, though, between using computers and modern transportation to round up millions of people into death camps, as Hitler did, and the historically natural death by starvation that happens to any species who have multiplied beyond their food supply? What are your thoughts on that?
I'm not sure I understand the angle of the question. action, because Hitler's point of view is that nature demands of us that we think racially and exterminate other races. That there was nothing, in fact, biologically or zoologically or naturally determined about that. That was a matter of policy. And of course, Hitler has the actual science 100% wrong when he denies that irrigation and hybridization and pesticides and fertilizers are going to work. He's completely wrong. In fact, within a few years, the problem for Europeans is they have too much food, not too little. So the Holocaust is a matter of political choices that are justified by a certain extremely pessimistic view of nature, and one which excludes the possibility that scientific innovation can change the relationship between people and their natural environment. So that kind of thing is very different from natural selection. Hitler claims that it's the same thing as natural selection, but it's not. The danger that I see is that as conditions get objectively worse, then the kinds of politics that Hitler propounded, personalizing a sense of anxiety or a sense of envy, rather than working structurally to improve the future, those kinds of politics become ever more tempting. And I'm afraid whether one looks at the rise of the Popular Front in France, or populist nationalism in Europe in general, or the current presidential debates in the U.S., we are already tipping in that direction.
So from your studies, as we start to wrap up here, do you think there's a way that we could immunize humanity to any degree against this urge to use mass murder during periods of climate stress?
Of course there is. The sense that everything must happen in the present moment, the sense of what I call in the book ecological panic, it's something that we're capable of. That's the lesson of history. We can be pushed in that direction. We can stand over a pit in Belarus and Lithuania and shoot babies on the logic that it's them or us. We have demonstrated that we can do that. But we have also demonstrated that we're capable of building out the fourth dimension of time. We are capable of looking back into the past and learning, and we are capable of inventing scientific techniques which allow us to believe that there's going to be a future. We're also capable of that. Both of those things are possible, and you know, the Germans, for that matter, have done each of those things. So that what that leaves us with is the possibility of choice, the reality of political choice, the reality, which is a little bit frightening, that we actually have responsibility for which way things go. We can choose to believe that all that's left is conflict, or we can choose to try to behave in such a way that builds out a future for us and for everyone else. But that is down to us.
Briefly, what is your latest book and what are you working on now?
Well, the latest book is the one that we've mostly been talking about, which is Black Earth, the Holocaust as History and Warning. Most of the book is devoted to history. I develop at great length an argument about how Hitlerian ideology interacts with a sense of ecological panic and works itself out throughout Europe insofar as states are destroyed. At the end of the book, in its conclusion, I develop a few scenarios about risk for the present and future. What I'm working on now, mostly I'm drawn into thinking about these connections between present and past. I'm looking forward to a future in which I could occupy myself with something else entirely.
Me too. our guest is Dr. Timothy D. Snyder, author and professor of history at Yale University. Tim Snyder has written a series of authoritative books on mass murders by the Soviets and the Nazis. Find links to Dr. Snyder and his books in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Tim, thank you so much for spending time with us on Radio EcoShock.
So glad I could. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith. We are pushing the end of our time, at least for this Radio EcoShock show this week. I'm Alex Smith. As always, thank you very much for listening and caring about our world.
Well, Cook County has now set a new record for rainfall after being hit hard this year. According to the National Weather Service, Gainesville has received nearly 80 inches of rain this year, the most all-time in about a 30-county region in North Texas, stretching from Waco to the Red River.
Paul, look at this. Today's rain so bad it flooded out Zoo Miami.
I have been here for 36 years working for the zoo, and I have never seen anything even close to this in November and December. These weather patterns have changed dramatically. This rain is historic as far as the zoo is concerned.
Hierarchs. I think a decent case can be made that hierarchs are really crazy, that hierarchy constitutes a mental illness. To prove that, all we have to do is tie together some of the things I talked about in previous segments, like pieces in a hierarch crazy puzzle. Let's start with the right to rule. This right to rule is a necessary component to hierarchy. If rulers do not possess some claimed right to rule, the rest of us have no duty to obey. But as we all know, this imaginary right to rule has no rational basis. And so the very cornerstone at the foundation of hierarchy is as real as magical beans and fairy dust. That means there's a big fat delusion. That's the basis of the hierarch myth. Hierarchs are operating under a belief system that's contradictory to reality, as real as Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, or compassionate conservatives. Delusion, a symptom of mental illness. So there's that. More recently, I talked about freedom, the absence of external regulation. Since freedom and external regulation are opposites, and since governments are external regulators, freedom and government are opposites. Where there's freedom, there's an absence of government, and where there's government, there's an absence of freedom. This is a simple, irrefutable truism. And yet hierarchs, who we already established are delusional, operate from a false belief that government does the exact opposite of what government does. They believe that government, the opposing force to freedom, protects freedom. To believe government protects and defends freedom is to believe that coyotes protect and defend the hen house. So we put these things together, and hierarchs are delusional people who believe that rulers have a right to rule, which is as real as magical beans and fairy dust, and that they exercise that right to rule to do the exact opposite of what governments really do. And that means we're dealing with a complex delusional construct. But there's more to it. Hierarchs also believe the existence of rulers to be necessary, since humans are stupid and selfish and foolish. They irrationally believe that life is better if we submit ourselves to be ruled by stupid, selfish, foolish.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
That's more than utopian. It's delusional. So taken all together, the delusion we call hierarchy holds that we are all better off being ruled by stupid, selfish, foolish people who claim some right to rule that doesn't really exist, so that government can do the exact opposite of what government provably exists to do. And the mentally ill people who accept this pathology really believe that there's no better way to live. These folks really drank the Kool-Aid. They defend the supremacy of their delusional construct, despite the thousands of years of hierarchy's consistent failure to ever live up to its promises, to ever work as advertised. In the realm of social and political organization, hierarchy is the equivalent to the Sea Monkeys ad that you see in the back of a comic. Hierarchy is such a powerful delusion, though. Hierarchs are completely unable to see the world as it is. They view everything through the lens of this irrational construct. That's why they look at 8,000 years of greater and greater devastation and calamity as progress. For the delusional and the irrational, hierarchy's abysmal failures everywhere, leading to toxic air, toxic water,
toxic land, acceleration of mass extinction, and the demonstrable increase of human immiseration and suffering, somehow proves the success of hierarchy. Yes, to the Looney Tunes, failure is an indication of success. Hierarchs are so mentally ill that they cannot so much as entertain the idea that maybe, just maybe, the worst possible thing that ever happened in the history of ever just might not be all that in a bag of chips. Despite the catalog of misery in front of their noses, these Kool-Aid drinkers are still convinced that the solution to the problem is more Kool-Aid. Taken together, this is a pathology, a mental illness. And not only are hierarchs crazy, but they are the most brutal and intolerant crazies in the whole history of irrationality. If you so much as question any component of their pathology, if you present a rational objection to their collection of magical beans, these whack jobs will destroy you. They will criminalize you, toss you into a gang, diagnose you with a mental illness, put you on no-fly lists, and maybe even kill you. They will apply all the pressures that their delusional construct brings to bear in order to force you to drink their Kool-Aid. Their blind and militant adherence to the irrational program at all costs, even at the price of complete omnicide, reminds me of their prior treatment of a couple of famous dead guys. Galileo and Copernicus had the audacity to challenge long-held assumptions that were integral to the hierarch's myth. These two intellectual rebels claimed that the Earth was round and that the Earth revolved around the Sun. Implications of their rebel ideas called into question the reality of the hierarch God that the hierarch high priests had manufactured. They were both criminalized, labeled as gang members, diagnosed as demon-possessed, and put on the no-wagon list. Facing the very real possibility of being burned at the stake, they recanted their offensive claims, rejoining the Flat Earthers at sword point. Delusional hierarchs don't burn you at the stake anymore. They now extend the torture out over a longer duration of time. But the same irrational madmen still run the asylum, and the asylum has gone global. Well, the Flat Earth variety of global anyway. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility in Lucasville. If you're listening, don't drink the Kool-Aid. It's the very definition of insanity to do the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. So imagine how crazy you'd have to be to do the same thing year after year, generation after generation, century after century, for about 8,000 years, and still expect a different result. For 8,000 years or so, hierarchs have recognized the ruler's right to rule, have accepted the duty of obedience, have asserted that government is necessary to defend freedom, have claimed that the rabble are too foolish, stupid, and selfish to rule themselves. They've recognized a right to rule and a duty to obey that are as real as magical beans and fairy dust. They've asserted that government, an external regulator, defends freedom, the absence of external regulation. And they've claimed the rabble are better off being ruled by others who are foolish, stupid, and selfish. That's the hierarch package for 8,000 years. We need foolish, selfish, stupid rulers to assert a right to rule that doesn't really exist, so that government can do the opposite of what governments do. And the hierarchs have, over 8,000 years, expected a different result from the last time they recognized a ruler, or the time before that, or the time before that. It matters not the method of the ruler's selection. We can read in the book of Samuel that the old Hebrew God, in response to the popular demand for a king, told the prophet what kind of misery they'd be facing if they accepted the rule of one human being over others. Even the old Hebrew God was opposed to this hierarchy crap. So whether appointed by gods or by pulling swords out of rocks, striking down giants with slingshots, or inheriting authority, all of the rulers have continued to provide us with unhappy endings. Those rulers resulted in our exploitation, in wars, in poverty, and the enforcement of tyrannical laws. But now hierarchy has evolved. Now, rather than leaving the selection of our rulers to such arbitrary forces as gods or swords and rocks, slingshots or genetics, we vote for our rulers. Yeah, the same rabble who are too foolish, stupid, and selfish to rule themselves, according to the hierarch myth, are allowed to vote and select their ruler, who is then a foolish, stupid, selfish ruler elected as a consequence of resonating with the largest number of foolish, stupid, selfish rabble. Yeah, That's much better than the rabble ruling themselves. So as a consequence of selecting our rulers through this method, we no longer have the same old exploitation, war, poverty, and tyrannical laws. No, we now have super-exploitation, continuous war, abject poverty on a global scale, and the most ridiculous tyrannical laws ever conceived. All this immiseration drives and provokes even people of goodwill to such thoughts of rebellion that it's now contemplated by those who assume the right to rule that the rulers may have to do away with their subjects altogether. All of us rabble have become expendable to the quest of achieving our own happiness, and it may soon become necessary to shoot all of us if the toxic environment doesn't get us first. After 8,000 years of disappointment and sorrow, we see poor deluded hierarchs still maintaining their assigned seats, marching in lockstep and dragging stones at the side of the pyramids owned by the privileged few, naively convinced that once the pyramid construction is complete, everything will be coming up roses. They're still completely mesmerized by the hierarch delusion, unable to question the right to rule, the duty to obey, the real purpose of government, or whether hierarchy is a practical solution. So under gunpoint, with drones flying around our homes and the thought police sifting through our emails and phone calls, millions are still prepared to go to the polls and cast their ballots, choosing yet another ruler, hoping that this time, for the first time in 8,000 years, we'll somehow get a different result. The definition of insanity, to do the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility in Lucasville, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance. Many times heard historians argue that the U.S. lost in Vietnam because those in charge did not understand the reality on the ground. Yeah, the reality on the ground. But if those in charge don't know the reality on the ground, what other reality is there? Hierarchy is good at producing delusional hierarchs, all too practiced in not seeing the reality on the ground. To recap, the false mythology of the hierarchs is built on a right to rule, which imposes a duty to obey, both of which have no rational basis in reality. The false mythology of the hierarchs asserts that government protects and defends freedom when the very opposite is provably true in reality. And the false mythology of the hierarchs views the catastrophic consequences of 8,000 years of hierarchy as signs of success and progress rather than evidence of abysmal failure. As I already argued, you must be delusional to be a hierarch. You have to accept false realities. But being a hierarch doesn't just require you to be crazy, it makes you crazy. The hierarch delusion compels you to accept the total preposterous as true. So we get good at it. We pretend our teachers are imparting valuable knowledge to serve us in gaining employment that will be satisfying and fulfilling. We pretend doddering old pedophiles have a hotline to a fantastical, self-contradictory God. We pretend bosses don't rob us of our time and labor. We pretend wars and prisons are necessary. We pretend economies are real things. We pretend colored pieces of paper with dead slave owners' faces on them are really worth something. And it goes on and on. But that's the kind of internal dishonesty you need when you're trapped in hierarchy, a system that is to human social organization what an ice cream truck is to interplanetary spaceflight. No matter how much you tinker with it and modify it, it ain't gonna work. All the duct tape in the world can't fix it. When we view hierarchy as a pathology, as a mental illness, as a mass delusion, we recognize that millions are trained from birth, generation after generation, for thousands of years, not to see the reality on the ground. Millions are trained to believe that those in power have a right to rule, that the rest of us have a duty to obey, that government protects and defends freedom, that the rabble cannot be trusted to self-rule. That is, of course, the broken record of a hierarch delusion. But some deluded hierarchs are more enthusiastic about these false myths than others. They are so steeped in the pathology that they dedicate themselves to it entirely. They aren't satisfied to merely take orders, but believe themselves singularly qualified to give orders. they seek power over others. That means those who seek and gain positions of power are even more delusional than the poor hierarchs just going along with the miserable program. Back to the analogy, they don't want to be passengers, they want to fly the ice cream truck. So those who are in charge are necessarily more delusional than those following orders. And that means, in hierarchy, the more delusional you are, the more powerful you'll get. Since hierarchs are Fruit Loops, that means those hierarchs who seek power are Fruit Loopier, and those hierarchs who are most powerful are the Fruit Loopiest. That means anyone who has ever been in charge has been nuts. The hierarchiest of the hierarchs, the craziest of the crazies, the Fruit Loopiest of the Fruit Loops. That explains a lot. The George Bushes and Dick Cheneys and Richard Nixons of the world aren't more qualified than the Walmart manager or the city council member. They're more hopped up on the hierarch mythology. And the George Bushes, Dick Cheneys, and Richard Nixons are only slightly surpassed in hierarch craziness by the likes of Hitler, Mussolini, and Attila the Hun, who believed in hierarchy so deeply they wanted to run everything. With all the practice they've had since birth in avoiding it at all costs, no wonder those who assume the right to rule can never see the reality on the ground. That's not a virtue valued by the delusional hierarchs. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility in Lucasville. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain 243-205, P.O. Box 45699, 1724 State Route number 728, Lucasville, Ohio 45699. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present David Pomerantz of Greenpeace USA, who assesses the agreement signed by 195 nations at the recently concluded UN Climate Summit in Paris. Leticia Colon de Mejias, who talks about how she became an environmentalist and climate activist, and the importance of conservation in reducing energy consumption and carbon emissions. And Gabrielle Hetland, Assistant Professor of Latin American Studies, who analyzes the results of Venezuela's recent election, where the ruling United Socialist Party lost control of the nation's legislature. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After an initial surge, France's anti-immigrant, anti-Islamist National Front Party failed to win any of the nation's regions in the second round of elections. National Front leader Marine Le Pen led in the first round in the northern French district near Calais, that is suffering with a 15% unemployment rate and is the site of a large migrant encampment. But when the socialist candidate pulled out of the final round, the vote swung to the former Conservative Party employment minister, a tactical retreat repeated in other districts that deprived the National Front of victory. Despite coming in third place in the regional elections, the National Front has made tactical gains in the run up to the 2017 French presidential election. After the election results were reported, France's socialist Prime Minister Manuel Valls declared, "Tonight there is no relief, no triumphalism, no message of victory. The danger of the far right has not been removed, far from it." In the end, the mainstream parties split control of regional governments, with former President Nicolas Sarkozy's conservative Les Républicains party winning 7 regions and the socialists 5. Paris political scientist Thomas Guénolé opined, "Everybody lost this election, especially the French voters who only cast a vote against something. There are voters who suffocated from lack of choices and alternatives offered by the mainstream parties. They want to be able to vote for something once again." Republican insurgent Ted Cruz is using a massive database of psychological profiles on millions of Facebook users to target potential voters for his conservative presidential campaign. In recent weeks, Cruz has mobilized growing numbers of Tea Party and evangelical voters, especially in Iowa. According to the Guardian newspaper, Cruz has hired little-known British data firm Cambridge Analytica to build personality profiles of potential voters using personal data without the knowledge of most Facebook users. The firm was hired with funds from Cruz's super PAC called Keep the Promise One, largely financed by hedge fund mogul Robert Mercer. The large database of Facebook likes is matched with other voter databases to identify traits such as who may own a gun. Documents obtained by The Guardian show Cambridge Analytica's London-based parent company, Strategic Communications Laboratories, was first introduced to the concept of using social media data to model human personality traits in early 2014 by Dr. Alexandra Kogan, a lecturer at Cambridge University's renowned psychology department. Kogan compiled a massive database of over 40 million people in the U.S. with detailed personality profiles. Over the last few years, conservative political campaigns, including GOP presidential candidate Ben Carson, have hired Cambridge Analytica to employ its millions of profiles to design targeted political messages on multiple platforms. Texas evangelical preacher Bob Roberts fits the profile of a conservative minister looking to spread the gospel far and wide. His spiritual journey has taken him to unusual places like Doha, Qatar, to build interfaith understanding between Christians and Muslims. Over the last 30 years, Roberts has emerged as a leading opponent of Islamophobia. Roberts, who leads a 3,000-member evangelical church outside of Dallas, has been honored by the White House for his interfaith work. The pastor told the Christian Science Monitor, "Right now the biggest challenge is in my tribe, the evangelicals. The battle for religious tolerance has only gotten tougher in the wake of the mass shooting in San Bernardino and the call by Republican frontrunner Donald Trump to ban all Muslim immigration into the United States. So it's surprising that there are a growing number of evangelical mosque partnerships emerging. In July, 3 Muslim charities raised $100,000 in a crowdfunding campaign to help rebuild 8 black evangelical congregations in the American South that were targets of suspected arson. After a shooting incident at a military recruiting station in Chattanooga, Tennessee in July, Franklin Graham, the son of famed evangelist Billy Graham, complained on Facebook, "We are under attack from Muslims at home and abroad. We should stop immigration of all Muslims to the U.S. until this threat from Islam has been settled." Along with Muslim advocacy groups, Roberts condemned Graham's hateful post on Facebook during a press conference, stating, "Standing up for the rights of Muslims to worship impacts the rights of Christians to worship around the world." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
While U.S. President Barack Obama and other world leaders hailed the agreement hammered out between 195 countries at the United Nations Paris Climate Summit as a success and a turning point, many climate activists while acknowledging areas of progress, took a more critical view. Pledges from 186 of the 195 nations participating in the summit to reduce the growth of their greenhouse gas emissions, to limit a rise in global temperatures to 2 degrees Celsius, but pursue a limit of 1.5 degrees, is commendable. But according to various research groups, even if every nation honored their announced carbon emission reduction targets, the world would still be headed toward a 3.5 degrees Celsius rise in temperature by the end of the century. That increase, scientists predict, can lead to crop failures, food shortages, and widespread plant and animal life extinctions. The Paris Climate Agreement is not legally binding, in large part because the Republican Party, which controls the U.S. Congress, would never have approved this global treaty. But other provisions in the deal call for mandatory 5-year review of greenhouse gas reduction pledges from each country, with transparency in the efforts made to reach national carbon emission goals. Your reporter spoke with David Pomerantz, a senior climate and energy campaigner with Greenpeace USA, who assesses the strengths and weaknesses of the climate agreement and the hard work ahead for climate activists across the globe.
It's pretty significant that the vast majority of humanity effectively has come together and said some very basic things, and some things that hadn't been said before. So, you know, one of the good things is that the Paris Agreement sets out the objective of limiting global temperature rises to 1.5 degrees Celsius. That's an extremely ambitious target. It's a target that would have been much easier to reach if we'd made this kind of agreement 20 years ago. Unfortunately, the political leaders of the world have wasted a lot of time. But it is important that has finally been put on paper. It's been agreed to by all the large emitters of the world, including the U.S. and China and India and many others. And so that's really significant. The bad, I think, is that the plans, the intended plans that every country has submitted, including the U.S., it's widely recognized they're not going to cut it to get down to that 1.5 degree temperature rise limit that the agreement strives for. The best science we have would indicate that the plans that the countries have put forward would leave us more in the 3 to 3.5 degrees Celsius range. So that's really significant. It would be catastrophic. And now Paris is from this point on, the starting point where we have to have a massive increase in ambition. So I would say this agreement certainly won't dig us out of the hole we've dug for ourselves as a planet, but it does make the sides a bit less steep.
David, as I understand it, in advance of the summit, many of the poorer nations around the world reiterated their need in order to cope with adaptation to climate change that is already going on and to also move to renewable energy sources in the future to mitigate their production of greenhouse gases that contribute to climate change, that they wanted a guarantee of some funding to do what they are unable to do themselves. What came out of the Paris conference for these developing nations that want to do something but don't have the economic means?
Yeah, like much of the agreement, that's another case where you have a good and bad side. So the finance text in the agreement was watered down pretty dramatically to get a deal. And unfortunately, the U.S. was a big part of why that happened. There is still some progress compared to where we were before Paris. Developed countries' existing commitment to mobilize $100 billion, that's U.S. dollars a year, for emissions reductions and adaptation in developing countries, that had been in place to 2020. It got extended out to 2025. So that's a good sign. Unfortunately, we're not seeing that level of funding now already. So countries have to step up to the plate even for what they've already committed to, and then absolutely need to see those numbers grow going forward. And there were some more ambitious financing elements that were removed from the text. So it's definitely an area where we need a lot more progress.
With the Paris Climate Summit concluded and many environmental and activist groups looking at it, believe there's some positive developments there, but it doesn't go far enough, fast enough. What is the role in your mind of civil society and grassroots activists organizations now to push the global community towards 100% renewable energy in order to avoid the scientifically predicted cataclysm of unmitigated climate change into the future?
Yeah, now is the time to move faster than ever. So far, the sort of the wheel of action on climate change has turned pretty slowly. But it did just sort of inch another little bit of the turn in Paris. And now with more and more people joining this very vibrant, diverse and growing climate movement every day, we have to make it turn faster and faster. You know, Paris, I think, was always important, but it was always just a stop in an ongoing journey. And we need to push harder and speed up. And I think people who consider themselves activists here in the U.S., or even if you don't consider yourself an activist, but you just, you know, you get it and you want to do something about it, there's no better time than now. We have a presidential election coming up next year that is going to present some pretty radically different visions of what our energy future looks like. There are a million ways to push for 100% renewable energy just locally where you live. You know, to your listeners out there, if you haven't been a part of it yet, now's the time because we need you more than ever. And, you know, we're making progress, but we have a big job in front of us.
That was David Pomerantz, a senior climate and energy campaigner with Greenpeace USA. Find more views and analysis of the Paris Climate Summit Agreement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On December 9th, the Connecticut chapter of the League of Conservation Voters held its 15th annual environmental summit in Hartford. There, legislators gathered with environmental activists, many who are working on climate change, as the UN Climate Summit was underway in Paris. One of the keynote speakers was Rob Klee, commissioner of the State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, who said Connecticut, under the state's Democratic governor, Daniel Malloy, is pursuing an all-of-the-above energy policy with an emphasis on increasing the use of natural gas. The event's other keynote speaker was Leticia Colon de Mejias, a Puerto Rican mother and educator who quit her day job when she learned about the planetary threat of climate change. She became a climate activist, writing environmental books for children, and founded a company which employs 27 low-income people that retrofit homes and businesses for energy efficiency. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mejias, who explained how, in an effort to encourage civic responsibility in her children, she learned about the climate crisis that changed her life. She also discusses alternatives to the use of natural gas and expensive pipelines as a bridge to a renewable energy future.
We started this thing of watching documentaries with our kids one day a week, and one of the first documentaries we saw was Kilowatt Hours by Jeffrey Berry, which is about climate change and mountaintop removal. And that really made me feel very passionate that I didn't know that information before. I was upset and angry that no one had told me that when I leave my lights on or, you know, my phone plugged in, that I was wasting energy and that I was impacting the environment in a negative way. Knowing that information made me feel I needed to immediately share it with others. And so my kids and I, as a project, along with my husband, started developing ways to communicate that message locally. And that's really how we got started.
Do you think that Connecticut's philosophy and practice of all of the above energy consumption is the way to go, or do you think there's a better way?
The energy crisis is real, and it's a very broad problem. I think that the issue and concern I have with our state's current approach is that we are pushing gas as a renewable energy or a clean fuel, and that is actually false information. It's not that I'm against the use of natural gas. We do need to have energy, and I don't want brownouts and blackouts. It's that there are ways to offset the use of that gas, and we're spending billions of dollars on a pipeline. If we invested billions of dollars in efficiency and behavioral changes, we could possibly change this in such a way, and we haven't attempted it yet, where we don't need to build this billion-dollar pipeline, $8 billion pipeline, and we could create jobs locally, immediately, increasing our income and revenue right in our own state.
You've been doing a lot of work in the micro level where you've gotten families to, you know, use cleaner energy, use less energy. And even Rob Klee, who's the, you know, commissioner of the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, one of the questions raised to him was about conservation. And he said, oh, well, you know that we're really all about that. But, you know, he didn't emphasize it until it was asked as a question. And that's something I've raised a long time, too, is like conservation is the energy you don't use and you don't pay for. So What are your thoughts about what you've already done that's impacted this positively, or what you think could be done on a broader scale?
I think it's extremely important for us to talk about real facts and to look at the behavioral opportunities that there are. When we talk about our campaign of switch it off, which means to turn off your electronics when you're not using them, which would seem quite simple, but it actually isn't happening in many places. We talk about an immediate savings of 10 to 15%. That is a huge savings. And if you couple that with renewable resources, true renewable resources like solar, geothermal, hydroelectric, then you really are looking at, you know, maybe offsetting 50% of our energy use. And I think that's a real approach to an immediate reduction of fossil fuel and carbon emissions.
And one thing he said was that, you know, you need the solar and wind, for example, are intermittent. And so you need a base load like gas or like oil or coal. Well, now if you want to get away from oil and coal, the gas is supposed to be cleaner. How do you respond to that, that we can't just go with renewables and conservation, that we have to have this underlying support of a steady form of energy?
I think that anytime people in a position of power deny the scientific facts that are right in front of all of us and easily obtainable, like gas is not necessarily more clean than coal or oil, for example, and that it has other serious issues that have not yet been really explored in depth, like the process of fracking, the extraction of the gas, the implications on our water tables that brings, which are extremely important to all people, again, that you're really not looking at the problem as a whole. And what can we do to reduce our energy usage? Like immediately looking at our state buildings and saying, why do they have incandescents? Talking about turning our heat down to 68 degrees, or talking about deeply insulating and retrofitting our buildings and homes. Let's try that. Let's see what happens. And sure, if we need to have a buffer of some fossil fuel after we've done those insanely simple and low-cost measures, then yeah, we should talk about that next. But first, we need to take real actionable steps to reduce our energy consumption residentially, commercially, and in our state buildings.
Leticia Colon de Mejias, you work with mostly low-income minority populations, which tend to be underrepresented in the climate movement in the U.S., at least. What have you found to be effective in doing this work?
I think if people from diverse minority populations are given the information, which they've not been provided correctly, in school and in communities, that it's everyone's problem, it's affecting them, it's affecting their health, it's affecting our climate, it's going to overall affect everything around us, then they would get involved, absolutely. But they don't know, and you don't know what you don't know. So the first step is educating that population on how it relates to them and what they can do to join the fight to save our planet.
That was Connecticut climate activist Leticia Colon de Mejias. Learn more about her projects, including Green Eco Warriors, which focuses on environmental education for young people, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As Venezuelans went to cast their ballots in the nation's December 6th parliamentary election, the primary issue on the minds of most voters was the failing economy, skyrocketing inflation, and severe shortages of basic goods on store shelves across the country. When ballots were counted, the ruling United Socialist Party of Venezuela, founded by the late populist leader Hugo Chavez, suffered a humiliating defeat. The opposition Democratic Unity Front won 56% of the vote, while the socialists won just 41%. Under Venezuela's electoral system, the opposition now holds a two-thirds majority of seats in parliament and the power to challenge incumbent socialist president Nicolas Maduro's programs, appointments, and budget. Although U.S. politicians and corporate media have long attacked Venezuela's socialist government, in power for 17 years, as a dictatorship, President Maduro, Chavez's hand-picked successor, immediately recognized the opposition's landslide victory. But in a televised address, he reminded the nation of the long history of U.S.-supported coups in Latin America, including Washington's support for the attempted overthrow of Chavez in 2002, and blamed what he called the conservative counter-revolution for sabotaging the oil-dependent economy and destabilizing his rule. Your reporter spoke with Gabriel Hetland, assistant professor of Latin American, Caribbean, and U.S. Latino Studies at the University at Albany, State University of New York, who analyzes the results of the Venezuelan election and the fate of Hugo Chavez's political legacy, that he called socialism for the 21st century.
Hugo Chavez and his party won 16 out of 17 electoral contests when he was in office, and then of the 20 that have happened since he was elected in 1998, they won 18 of those. What happened in this election was that the opposition turned out very strongly, but just there was a slight increase in the opposition vote, about 4 to 5% compared to what it was in the 2013 presidential election in April. And there was a massive abstention on the part of Chavista voters, almost 2 million who stayed home compared to the turnout for the Chavista vote in that same election in April 2013. So the really big difference in turnout certainly explains the result, although there was about 400,000 voters roughly who switched sides. So clearly there is some defection of Chavista voters to the opposition. But I think the economic crisis that Venezuela has been facing over the last year and a half is really at the heart of the reason why some of the voters are switching and why many Chavistas were basically protesting against the government by not showing up to vote at all.
Now, a lot of voters, of course, blame the incumbent president, Nicolas Maduro, for the economic problems. But many Chavistas, people loyal to the United Socialist Party, have long thought that opposition parties aligned with the United States and other external actors were in some way responsible for at least part of Venezuela's economic problems. When you examine what economic issues are going on in Venezuela, inflation and the shortage of goods, where do you trace the problem to?
There's three things I think that are behind the current economic crisis. One of them is a fall in the price of oil, which has happened since about June 2014, when it was, I think, around $107, $108 a barrel. And about a week ago, at least, it was $37 a barrel. So there's been a massive fall in the price of oil, and Venezuela's budget is very dependent on oil. I think about 96% of their export earnings come from oil, and then 40 to 45% of the federal budget comes from oil. So when the price of oil drops, it's just a huge hit that the government and all the social programs and things that they've been spending money on for over a decade, they all take a hit as well. The second really important thing, and this is where the government has prime responsibility or certainly a large degree of responsibility, is a huge gap between the official exchange rate for the Bolivar, the Venezuelan currency, which is 6.3 to the dollar, and then the black market exchange rate has gotten up to over 800 to 1 to the dollar. So over 125 times, almost 150 times difference between the black market rate and the regular rate. The government's been afraid for various reasons to try to reduce that gap, which they would be able to do through a devaluation of the currency. The reason the government hasn't done that is at least partly because it would raise prices for certain goods, or at least that's the fear, that there'd be additional inflation. Some people think there's been so much inflation already that that's not a big fear, but there's questions about that. The third thing, and this is what the government's been saying, is that there's an economic war being waged against the government, against the sort of people of Venezuela by opposition sort of sympathetic business sectors that are hoping that the government will suffer, which they did in this election, if they can generate economic chaos within the country. It's somewhat difficult to find smoking gun evidence for this view. And to give you a sense of how Venezuelan people feel about it, there's been some recent polls, maybe a few weeks ago, showing that 70% of people in Venezuela didn't think that that was the main or even a primary cause of the economic crisis. And then the other 30% said, well, even if there's an economic war, the government's losing. So whether or not that's the key factor, people haven't been satisfied with the government's response to it.
Well, Gabriel, just a final question here is, with the United Socialist Party of Hugo Chavez and his successor at the helm, Nicolas Maduro, losing big time to the opposition in Venezuela, a lot of people have questions about the future of Chavez and his socialist revolution, which is credited with reducing poverty and advancing equality in Venezuela. What is your outlook for Chavez and his revolution after this defeat?
Yeah, I mean, I think they really have to acknowledge some responsibility for the economic mess the country's in. I don't think that the vote that happened on Sunday, December 6th, so about two Sundays ago, can in any way be seen as a mandate for free market capitalism.
It's really about correcting the economy. I think if the government can make progress towards correcting the economy, they can certainly stay in power. I think there's millions and millions in Venezuela who want a return to the policies that were helping to reduce poverty and inequality and unemployment and raising healthcare standards and giving people pensions when they didn't have it before. They really want to return to those policies. So doing that will require better policies to fix the economic mess the country's in. I don't think the opposition has great plans in order to do that. And so if the government can make some progress on that, I think that they can stay in power and continue to do some of the things they've been doing before. If they don't make progress on that, I think it's anyone's bet in terms of what might happen. There will probably be a recall referendum against Nicolas Maduro in particular if the economy stays bad. And if the economy is not being fixed at that point, it may be the case that more Chavistas vote against the government or that they just stay home. And that could certainly create the conditions for the opposition to win a recall and then set up a new contest for the presidency.
That was Gabriel Hetland, assistant professor of Latin American, Caribbean, and U.S. Latino studies at the University at Albany, New York. Find links to his recent Nation magazine article titled "Why Venezuela's Ruling Party Lost Big" and related analysis of the election by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Badge of the Rapist Racist. As the first phase of the trial of police officer Daniel Holdsclaw comes to a close, one is forced to take stock of what the trial and its coverage means. Holdsclaw, a 28-year-old white Oklahoma cop, was recently convicted of 18 charges of sexual assault, rape, sodomy, and related offenses, and the targeting and raping of some 13 black women, from teens to a woman in her 50s. An Oklahoma jury recommended the man be sentenced to some 260-plus years in prison. If you blinked, however, you would have missed it. A serial rapist of 13 females. When isn't that a story? When the 13 women are black women. Only one cable network, the black-owned TV One news program, hosted by former CNN contributor Roland Martin, covered the case using internet reports from persons in court. No one else. Not one. Why not? Apparently, black lives don't matter. Holtzclaw used his uniform, his badge, his service revolver, to stop, intimidate, and rape over a dozen women. Sometimes, in his own patrol vehicle. And amazingly, he raped a teenager on her porch. And people wonder why cops can't be trusted. It took DNA and GPS evidence to bust this dude. But how can anyone contemplate something so sick? Easy. Most of the victims were poor black women. Some charged with being sex workers. Others charged with being drug violators. In other words, the vulnerable. This cop chose those who he knew had no social power and little ability to resist. And media silence reinforced that negative narrative by belittling the worth of these women. If they had covered it, they would have cast a harsh national light on police practices. They chose not to. Like a cop standing over a body in the road, they essentially said, hey, keep on moving. There's nothing to see here. Keep moving. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. I confess to not watching the entire presidential debate. By 20 minutes, I could stand no more. I saw nothing more than a pack of dogs yelping fear, hatred, ignorance, and enmity at the world around them. They bayed at the moon, a chaotic chorus of blood, barking war, death, bombs, kill. It was as astonishing as it was ugly. There were no words. There were merely snarls at a world that dared outgrow them, that no longer regarded them as the moneyed masters of the universe. With few exceptions, they paid tribute to the ignorance that birthed the disaster in Iraq, or that nursed their CIA, MI5, ISI, and Saudi-trained and paid assassins now nipping at their heels. They growled at immigrants, even though all of them, save one, were sons or granddaughter of immigrants. That one, a grandson of slaves. Hounds may bay at the moon, but they can't move it an inch. Dogs may chase a bus, but they can't really catch one. These dogs of war may open the door to carnage, but it will be your sons and daughters who suffer and die on the blooded altar of political ambition. They will bury their charred remains, grant them a medal, and step over their shredded bodies in pursuit of vain political advantage. This war, started in imperial hubris, will wage until our grandchildren are elderly, no matter what. And these politicians will bay at the moon with more murder on their minds. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, what did you accomplish by your testimony today in court?
I think I've opened a window, not just to what I've suffered or even my case, but how the state responds to those thousands of people. At last count, and I think it's a serious undercount, 10,000 prisoners in Pennsylvania, how they respond to the challenge of hepatitis C. That is to say, they'll do everything they can not to treat those who have been infected with hepatitis C infections.
How sick were you on March 30th, 2015?
I was as weak as a kitten. I still have no independent memory of me going there. I don't actually remember falling into a coma or a diabetic shock. I remember going into the infirmary and waking up the next day, presumably, or what I thought was the next day, because we couldn't see out the windows, at a hospital. And the feeling of wool in my mouth. They gave me water, and water tastes like cotton. I remember those things, but I was so weak I could barely lift my arm.
What relief are you seeking?
Something very simple. Treatment. Not treatment of the symptoms, but treatment of the disease, hepatitis C. They could do it tomorrow. And in 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks, or at the outside, 28 weeks, there's a 95, 98% chance I'll be cured. And the hepatitis C virus will be eradicated and undetectable in my system.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, what reasons did the Department of Corrections give for denying you care for hepatitis C?
They told me, or it was told to me by the doctor here, that I was not sick enough to qualify, that my viral load wasn't large enough and my platelet count was too low. That I was too healthy to be treated. I wasn't sick enough.
Did they repeat those questions in the courtroom?
They insinuated it. They made reference to people reporting that I look better, me telling the dermatologist that I feel great. I do feel great compared to how I felt, and people have told me that I look good. But I think I also did not hesitate to mention that the doctor here said this can recur at any time. And so, you know, I can look good today and be back in that state in a month, a week, a year, tomorrow.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radioactive contamination of the Pacific Ocean. The global impacts of methane and Arctic warming. The Pentagon and NATO encirclement of Russia and China. The world's indigenous games as cover for anti-indigenous legislation in Brazil. The coercive sterilization of indigenous women in Canada. Why are these and other stories not getting enough attention in the media? What were the major events of 2015, and what impacts will they have going into 2016? On this week's Global Research News Hour, the last regular show for 2015, we will examine some of the most important underreported stories of the year. We'll be joined by John Chertow of intercontinentalcry.org, Andy Lee Roth of the media initiative Project Censored, and by commentator, author, and retired Bartle Professor of Sociology, James Petras. On this week's program, 2015, reviewing the most important and the most censored stories of the year. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 18th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. President Putin has been clear. Russia will use nuclear weapons if necessary, if conventional forces are threatened. If Ankara opts for a suicide mission of knocking out yet another Su-24 or Su-34, Russia will simply clear the airspace all across the border via the S-400s. If Ankara, under the cover of NATO, responds by launching the Turkish army on Russian positions, Russia will use nuclear missiles, drawing NATO into war not only in Syria, but potentially also in Europe. And this would include using nuclear missiles to keep Russian strategic use of the Bosphorus open. That's how we can draw a parallel of Syria today as the equivalent of Sarajevo 1914. That comes from the article, You Want War? Russia is Ready for War, by Pepe Escobar, posted December 16th, originally appearing at Sputnik News. The Western narrative currently tries to show that it is Russia, and only Russia, which is keeping Assad in power. But this is completely false. The reality is that both Hezbollah and Iran are fully committed to preventing Daesh from overthrowing the Syrian government, and their commitment has gone way further than words. Hezbollah has sent hundreds of its best fighters to Syria, and Iran has committed thousands of soldiers, mostly of the Al-Quds Brigade, to the war in Syria. What this level of determination shows is that, just like Russia, Iran and Hezbollah have concluded that their vital existential interests are at risk and that they have no choice than to take the fight to Daesh. I believe that this assessment is absolutely correct. That comes from the article, Week 10 of Russia's Intervention in Syria, The Empire's Reckless Arrogance, by The Saker, posted December 16th, originally appearing at the UNZ Review. The continued reliance on the neoliberal model of structural reform within the framework of a post-Washington consensus on the need to bring the state back into the development process, together with the turn towards and a continued reliance on extractive capital, resource-seeking FDI, constitutes serious economic, social, and political problems for Latin American states seeking to break away from the dictates of global capital and the clutches of imperial power. However, the turn of the state in Latin America towards regulation in regard to the operations of extractive capital, as well as the growing popular resistance and opposition to their destructive and negative socio-environmental impacts of these operations, also constitute major problems for global capital. The difference is that the capitalists and companies that operate in the extractive sector are able to count on the support and massive resources and powers of the imperialist state. In regard to the issue of regulation, the states and international organizations that constitute imperialism have been able to mobilize their considerable resources and exercise their extensive powers to create a system of corporate self-regulation in the form of a doctrine of a corporate social responsibility doctrine. With this doctrine, the Latin American states that have turned to or resorted to a strategy of natural resource development have been under tremendous pressure to allow the companies that operate in the extractive sector to regulate themselves. That comes from the article Imperialism and Capitalism, Rethinking an Intimate Relationship by Professor James Petrus and Professor Henry Veltmeyer, posted December 16th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The website intercontinentalcry.org has, for the last decade, served as a hub of cutting-edge news and analysis of issues affecting and facing the more than 6,000 indigenous nations worldwide. Joining us now to talk about some of the world's major underreported indigenous stories of 2015 is John Anawanka Shurto. He's the founder of Intercontinental Cry. So thank you very much for joining us, John.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Okay, so you did flag a few stories, and I'll just try. We'll just go through a few of them. Here's a major one: the Real World Indigenous Games in Brazil. Brazil approves major anti-indigenous legislation while the media keeps us entertained. And this is in reference to the anti-indigenous legislation in question is the PEC 215. So, do you want to maybe just give us a bit of background about what that story was all about?
Well, just to clarify, PEC is the Portuguese abbreviation for a proposed constitutional amendment, and this particular piece of legislation has been opposed extensively by indigenous peoples in Brazil for over 2 years. They've been trying to stop this law from being approved because it would give Congress unprecedented powers to control indigenous borders. So they could erase them or change them as they see fit without any consultation. So, you know, there's been a huge movement to stop this from moving forward. But the Indigenous Games, it turned out, while the media was going on and on and on about, you know, how amazing the games were and how beautiful all these indigenous women were, you know, there was pageants with indigenous women showing off traditional regalia, and you know, the mainstream media covered it extensively. You know, they were just loving every minute of it, right? And in the midst of this, while Brazil was going on and on and on about how wonderful it is and how everybody in the world should come there and spend their money and blah blah blah, Congress slipped this bill in and gave it an approval. Despite the fact that just, you know, a few months prior, Congress promised Brazil's indigenous people that they would throw this bill into the garbage. And there was actually, a huge celebration about it. But that's only, you know, the tip of the iceberg. There was a bunch of unfortunate happenings taking place in Brazil during the games that nobody actually covered. As far as I know, IC was the first publication in North America to actually expose what was happening inside the games. There was some several protests that took place opposing the...
there were massive mobilizations, were there not?
I wouldn't say massive, but there were numerous protests, yeah. And, you know, like television networks kind of flashed over it here and there, and there were maybe a couple dozen articles, not even that many. But there were also, you know, several difficulties reported by the indigenous volunteers who were taking part in the games. According to several of the volunteers, they were basically treated like slaves. They were given one meal a day. you know, they were literally being starved. They had no access to water. They were sleeping on cement, you know, in the you know, working full time under the boiling sun with no access to air-conditioned zones. Even though there were air-conditioned areas there, the organizers weren't letting the indigenous peoples go into those areas. Mm-hmm. So they're like, they're basically being tortured practically.
And yeah, there's an unsafe working conditions and risk involved too, eh?
Yeah, and there were, you know, reports of ceiling collapse as well, just all sorts of problems, dehydration, people were suffering from dehydration, and journalists apparently were told that they weren't allowed to talk about this. They weren't allowed to say anything bad about the games. And as a result, I guess everybody bowed to that threat and kept silent about it. Mm-hmm. So throughout the games, everybody was smiling and also happy about everything that was oh so perfect. Meanwhile, you know, there's all this stuff happening behind the scenes that nobody covered.
Interesting. And this all seemed to be servicing, you know, group of people that might be smiling in particular, I imagine, would be the agribusiness companies.
Well, and Brazilian Congress, because at this point, like, there's, like, Brazil's agribusiness lobby is extremely powerful. They're also, specific segments of the lobby is militarized and extremely racist. You know, they're well known for organizing anti-indigenous campaigns. The president of Brazil works hand in hand with one woman. I can't recall her name, but she's known as the Chainsaw Queen. So they're working hand in hand with Congress and the agribusiness lobby to, you know, undermine indigenous rights. And there are actually about a half a dozen different ministerial orders and proposed constitutional amendments in Brazil, all targeting indigenous land rights and environmental protections in Brazil, much like the suite of legislation that Harper pushed forward here in Canada just prior to the launch of Vital No More. It's the same thing happening in Brazil. And But the PEC 215 has been the main focus, because that's the imminent threat right now. And, you know, I can't see the indigenous peoples in Brazil taking this, sitting down. When the bill was first proposed in 2013, 700 indigenous leaders occupied Brazil's House of Representatives. You know, they stormed it, mm-hmm. Forcing Brazil's Congress to refuse to push it forward, which is ultimately why I imagine that the gains were used to get the to quietly push the bill forward, but they're not going to let it go through. Mm. There's just no chance.
Okay, another story. Just to move along to, because there are a lot of other very important stories, I want to make sure people get a bit of a representative sampling. You've got another story here. This is by contributor France Rivet about 8 Labrador Inuit who were brought over to Europe about 136 or 34 years ago, or 136 years ago, and their remains remain there, and they were essentially trapped in a human zoo for exhibition from people out there. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that story there?
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's actually France Reveille. She's the author of a book called In the Footsteps of Abraham Al-Kharab, the events of 1880 to 1881. France has actually been instrumental in the effort to bring the remains of the Inuit home. So, like, the story starts in 1880 during, you know, in the midst of Canada's war of attrition against Indigenous peoples, where everyone here is basically being, you know, divided, segregated, and starved to death. And in the midst of this, a Norwegian ethnologist approached Abraham, who had been converted to Protestantism by the Moravian Church, offered to take Abraham and his family to Europe to demonstrate their way of life to the public in exchange for money. Now, this was probably a hard decision for Abraham, but he ultimately decided that, you know, it was an opportunity for him to provide some relief for his family. So he decided to go. And with him, he took his wife, their two daughters, a single man from Hebron, Labrador, and a traditional Inuit family of three. And, you know, soon after his arrival in Germany, they quickly, Abraham quickly realized that they should not have gone on this journey. You know, they were extremely homesick. But, you know, things got worse just after a month or so. After spending their days being exhibited in Berlin, Prague, Prague, Frankfurt, and Darmstadt, the first of many tragedies struck when one of the Inuit, Nugsak, who was aged 15, suddenly and unexpectedly died. The doctors, you know, thought she had a stomach ulcer, and then everybody mourned her loss, and they kind of just moved on. But then just 9 days later, Nugasak's mother suddenly fell ill with the same symptoms. 4 days after that, the youngest of the group, age three, Abraham's daughter, sorry, she's not the youngest, the second youngest, you know, started getting sick as well. And then suddenly the doctors realized that they were dealing with smallpox. By January 16th, they were all dead. And from that point on, basically, this story essentially ends. The Inuit's belongings were sent home along with a diary that Abraham kept during their journey. But then, you know, nobody really heard about this story again until really 1980, when a Canadian ethnologist discovered a copy of Abraham's diary. 25 years after that, the diary was translated to English. And in more recent times, in 2009, France discovered the story, and she asked a question that nobody had ever answered. What happened to the remains? So after a year of investigation, she'd found that the remains were actually in Paris. And France, being from France, took this as a sign that that she needed to take this on, and ever since then she's been working as the go-between between Germany, France, Canadian government, and the government of Nunavut to bring everyone's remains home. Mm-hmm. And this is an ongoing story. In fact, the official request for the repatriation of the remains could literally come tomorrow. Story is unfolding as we speak. And there's a documentary film forthcoming as well called Trapped in a Human Zoo. And I'm not sure when it's going to be released, but it's supposed to be airing on the CBC's Nature of Things.
Yes, it was supposed to happen this month, I think.
Yeah, November or December was when it was originally scheduled, but there's been some kind of delay. it's definitely on the way, though. And if people want to be updated about this, you know, they can keep an eye on IC because we're gonna put a spotlight on it as soon as it's out.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to bring up just one more story because it's just hot off the press, I guess you might say.
Yep.
And this is with regard to the sterilization of Indigenous women, and this is an act of genocide. It just came out the day that we're having this conversation. It's called An Act of Genocide, Canada's Coerced Sterilization of First Nations Women. And I think that where there have been references to this in the mainstream, I think there was a CBC story about it, but it doesn't really provide much context. And it would be easy to just kind of dismiss it as just you get to the systemic aspects of this. Maybe you should – I'll let you expand on the main elements of this story that really need to be addressed.
Yeah, well, yeah, this situation has been systemically ignored by everybody. I first became extremely aware of Canada's history of sterilization about 15 years ago. It was the first story that I ever investigated when I got access to the internet. Since then, I've been keeping an eye out for coverage on this, and the world was basically silent until this year, when Dr. Karen Stout published a book called An Act of Genocide, and it focuses particularly on sterilization of Indigenous women in Ontario. What I noticed in all the coverage of Karen Stout's book and the interviews that she carried out was that nobody pointed out the fact that there were actually two pieces of sterilization legislation in Canada in the I'm not sure the exact date, 1900s, early 1900s, just before, actually, the Nazis passed the Nuremberg race laws that outlined the German Jews from having sexual or marital relations with anyone of German or mixed ancestry. Two provinces passed sterilization legislation. Alberta, in 1928 here, called the Sexual Sterilization Act. And then 5 years later, 1933, BC passed the Act Respecting Sexual Sterilization. And it didn't explicitly mention targeting Indigenous women or immigrants, but it has to be understood that there was a massive eugenics movement going on back then, and protecting the Anglo-Saxon race was a major reason for it. So, you know, it's kind of wink, wink, nod, nod, understood that part of the – one of the – that the undesirable traits that are mentioned in the legislation includes skin color. The problem is that because, one, this has been so completely ignored, two, it has been there's been no real research into this history. We don't actually know how many Indigenous women, men, and children were sterilized in Canada. The CBC's coverage should send off alarms across the board that not only is this being ignored, but this is an ongoing issue. It's not just something that happened, 60 years ago. Not that that's even reason to ignore it, because it's not. Like so much of Canada's history that's been, you know, fundamentally suppressed intentionally, you know, we have to start considering this. We have to investigate it. There are inquiries that are needed, much like the inquiry for murdered and missing Indigenous women and the work that has gone into exposing and quote-unquote reconciling everything that happened during residential schools. You know, these men, women, and children who were biologically disabled by the government in cooperation with the church needs to be addressed. And in order to address that, we need to, one, start stepping up. We need to start talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, it's especially important that this report is coming out just at the time where the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's final report is being released, and the Liberal government is reissuing the apology for the residential school crisis, and there's been a lot of messaging about how we've got to resolve the situation in a proper and respectful manner. So, I mean, I think that your website and the stories that come out through intercontinentalcry.org provides a very important and crucial context for all of this. I know we're kind of running at the end of our scheduled time, but I really wanted to put a question to you about, your thoughts after all these years of covering these stories and seeing them suppressed or ignored, even by a lot of indie media outlets. What are your thoughts about why that's happening? Is this garden variety racism or something more insidious?
Well, I've been asking myself that question for 10 solid years. I started IC precisely because of this. I didn't really grasp the reasons until recently, at least to an extent that I'm satisfied with. I'm not sure it's insidious. Maybe in some cases, in the case of the mainstream's coverage or non-coverage of indigenous struggles against mining, oil, hydro, and so forth, I'm sure there's a less than righteous agenda going on there. But I think there's really a collection of factors for the marginalization of indigenous peoples in the media. I'll just mention them quickly here. The first is the differences in language. This doesn't really pertain to journalists and indigenous peoples in Canada, but worldwide there's definitely a massive barrier there. The cost of authoring articles is another major factor, especially when it comes to independent media. With the limited coverage that most independent publications have, we all have to be quite selective about what we take on. And 9.9 times out of 10, independent publications are going to choose something local, something that's going to bring something more to them. And indigenous peoples usually don't enter into that picture. Another major factor is culture. The fact that colonial culture is a culture of guilt, doubt, blame, shame, denial, and fear. And there are many points of justification that people use to avoid speaking out and telling stories and doing something of substance to support indigenous peoples. And then, of course, there is the ever-present conflicts of interest, especially pertaining to corporate media. They don't want to talk much about Barrick Gold's adventures in Papua New Guinea and the systemic abuse and rape of indigenous women there. But the list could go on for hours. Conflict of interest is a massive factor there.
Okay, so listeners, if you're interested in hearing more about these sorts of stories, please remember to go to intercontinentalcry.org and just point out that there is a fundraiser going on till the end of December, and they're trying to raise money to help keep Intercontinental Cry a valuable resource. So that URL again is intercontinentalcry.org. So, John Anawanka Shirto, thank you very much for sharing this time and sharing those stories with us. And we hope to interview you again in 2016.
Certainly. I look forward to it.
John Anawanka Shirto is the founder of intercontinentalcry.org. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. The media literacy initiative known as Project Censored has been active chronicling and assembling the most underreported important stories of the previous year. Censored 2016 is releasing its list of the top 25 most censored stories of 2014 to 2015. And here to discuss those stories is one of Project Censored's editors, Andy Lee Roth. So, Andy, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to join you, Michael. Yes.
So, first of all, can you tell us about the methodology that you employ?
Well, the kind of hunting for, identifying, and then ultimately vetting and ranking our top 25 story list each year is really a year-round process. It involves a huge collection of people. This year's list is the represents the combined efforts of some 191 undergraduate students from 18 college and university campuses across the U.S. and Canada, 31 faculty members at those institutions, and another, I believe it's nine community experts. The faculty and the community experts act as evaluators of the students' summaries of the stories and their analyses of whether stories have received corporate coverage. When that process, which goes on for about 9 months of the year, is complete, we send off, we vote to whittle down what's approximately 200 to 300 stories, depending on the year. We whittle those down to a list of about 30, and then those are sent in the early spring to our panel of 28 international judges who actually vote to rank order the stories as they appear in the top 25 list in the book each year and on our website.
I've noticed that year after year, there are certain sorts of themes, or call them bureaus, if you will, that where you see representation on the environmental catastrophe front. You see representation in terms of police state surveillance kinds of stories and economic stories. And it seems to me even sort of like a positive stories or two about community resistance. Is that do you have to curate these stories in a way that you get some representation in each of those areas, or does it just naturally fall into place like that?
That's not a conscious effort, but it's interesting. I think you're quite right that there are kind of these recurrent themes. I like your idea of almost bureaus, although there are bureaus that arise not completely by happenstance, but they aren't a conscious effort on our part in terms of curating. I think those are, as you've mentioned, kind of economic inequality, challenges to the integrity of our environment, the threats to civil liberties and the like. These are the core kind of, I'm speaking now as a sociologist, these are sort of core social problems that don't go away. There is continuity even as we each year try to bring forward distinct stories that that are worthy of greater attention than they're getting in the corporate media.
Let's talk about a few of those stories. So you got in the number one position a story. It's called "Half of Global Wealth Owned by the 1%," and you were one of the you were the faculty evaluators for this story. It's in relation to an Oxfam report that came out in January 2015. Do you want to maybe touch on some of the key elements of that story?
Yeah, and I'll use this as a chance very quickly to just give a shout out. Each of these stories is of course originally reported by an independent reporter and published or presented by an independent news outlet. But students at Project Censored in Project Censored classes, and so in this case, a shout out to former students of mine, Izzy Michelson from Pitzer College and Ina Tunkel from Scripps College, are the ones who do the initial research on these. So they dug this story and found the Oxfam report that you mentioned. The Oxfam report focused on extreme inequality, as is, I think, fairly well covered in the corporate press. But what the Oxfam report, what Izzy and Ina, as they compared the independent news coverage that we have from sources like The Guardian and Oxfam's own report, what they found was that the independent news coverage was emphasizing aspects of the Oxfam report that the corporate media were ignoring, specifically the Oxfam report emphasizing that extreme economic inequality is not inevitable, but is the result of political choices and economic policies that are established and maintained by a kind of power elite. And the Oxfam report laid out a very clear 9-point plan that governments could adopt to address poverty and income inequality. And this aspect, too, when Izzy Michelson and Nina Tunkel, the students who took on this story and researched it, what they found was that in the corporate news, although the Oxfam report got some coverage, that aspect of the report, the solutions part of it, was completely elided. It was overlooked.
I want to bring up another story. This is number 5, the Fukushima nuclear disaster deepens. And I took note of it because, you know, global research is one of the contributors to that,
Michelle Chosudovsky's Fukushima Endgame story that came out at the end of 2014 is one of three stories that comprise our number 5 story. One of the key things here is if we take the official perspective, the United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency has commended Japan for making significant progress in cleaning up the Fukushima site. There have been assurances in the corporate media from government authorities and the major news media themselves that the situation is contained and improvement is is ongoing. But what we're starting to see, and I can update this even from what we published, Sensor 2016 came out in October of this year. We went to press with our great publisher, Seven Stories Press, earlier in the summer. And since then, what we're starting to see in October, we're starting to see the first peer-reviewed journal articles showing increased incidences of thyroid cancer in Fukushima Prefecture, incident rates that are 20 to 50 times the national level among people who are 18 years or younger. We know how we understand radiation contamination that it affects younger people first and more powerfully. We also have had, since the book went to press, TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, responsible for the operation of the Fukushima plants, has acknowledged that the first employee with leukemia. So we're starting to see what skeptics had predicted in the immediate aftermath of the Fukushima disaster. We're starting to see some of the long-term health consequences come to rise.
Now, there's another story that I really wanted you to touch on because it comes on the heels of this big COP21 conference. We are having this interview on the heels of the completion of the COP21 conference, and this is number 6, Methane and Arctic Warming's Global Impacts, and that's based on a story for Truth out by an outstanding independent journalist, Darja Mail. And it's the story, The Methane Monster Roars, from January 2015.
Yes, he does such great work in covering environmental issues, and this story is an exemplar of that. In Paris, when methane was discussed, it was discussed in the context of things like the fracking of natural gas and oil. And there are important points there that need to be addressed. What Jamail is talking about is not Arctic gas, not methane gas that is being released directly by human activity, but the release of and the potentially enormous catastrophic releases of methane gas that would result indirectly from human activity. Mm. So as Arctic ice melts, trapped methane is released into the atmosphere. And as one of the scientists Jamail talks with quips, it's not Vegas, but the Arctic. What happens in the Arctic does not stay in the Arctic. And one of the things that Jamail focuses on in his Truth Out report is the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. It covers some million square kilometers, and each year it releases about 17 million tons of methane into the atmosphere. This is as a result of Arctic warming. But an earlier study, a 2013 study that was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nature, reported that there's the possibility of a 50 gigaton burp of methane gas, and that this possibility was
fairly likely. And Jermel, to put that in perspective for us, a 50 gigaton burp of methane released in a very short time frame would be the equivalent of at least 100 gigatons of carbon dioxide. Now, since 1850, to put that in historical perspective, humans have released a total of approximately 1,475 gigatons of CO2. So to release in a single, you know, burp is the term that's actually used in this Nature article from 2013, to release a 50 gigaton burp of methane that would be the equivalent to almost 2/3 of the carbon dioxide we've released into the atmosphere in the last 160-some years would be a tremendous alteration of our atmosphere, and would have that would lead to temperature increases of 4 to 6 degrees Celsius in just a couple of decades, a rapid rate of climate change that things like human agriculture and ecosystems more generally would have a very difficult, if not impossible, time adapting to.
Yeah.
So that kind of concern was apparently not even on the table or up for discussion in Paris.
Yeah, this year's Censored has a number of fascinating stories here. I mean, there's global killing of environmentalists rises dramatically. The new Amazon of the North, Canadian deforestation. Pentagon and NATO encircle Russia and China. What can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, this is an interesting story. This is and this shows you the extent to which we're trying to dig to sources that are important but not readily known. This is a piece by Bruce Gagnon that was published in the Plymouth Institute for Peace Research in August of 2014. Basically, Gagnon's argument is that we can interpret what the Pentagon and NATO are doing with regard to Russia and China as efforts in service of corporate capital, and corporate capital's vested interests in the regions, in the two regions' natural resources. So he's identifying things like the U.S. military bases in Romania and Bulgaria, plans for additional bases in Albania as efforts to surround Russia. NATO similarly expanding into Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, with talk that there might be additional countries, that Georgia, Sweden, Finland, perhaps even the Ukraine would join NATO. And these, he understands, in line with comments by General James Jones, who was the Supreme Allied Commando of NATO in 2006. Jones commented that NATO deployment was designed to, quote, safeguard oil and gas fields in the Caspian Sea region. And there's a similar kind of argument with regard to China. The U.S. Navy regularly patrols seas outside of China's boundaries with destroyers that have missile capabilities. There are ground-based missile defense systems in South Korea, as well as those located at bases in Hawaii, Japan, Guam, Taiwan, Australia, and the Philippines. And so, you know, there's much more to this story, but that gives a sense, I think, of the kind of the big picture that Gagnon is taking in this article. And again, it's something that we don't see. We don't see that kind of macro view. Even if you scanned the paper or watched the news online, you might get bits and pieces of this, but it's kind of the connecting the dots to see, to interpret how it gives us a bigger picture is something that's been missing.
Andy Lee Roth, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Michael. It's a pleasure.
And Andy Lee Roth is one of the editors with Project Censored. You can go to the website projectcensored.org to get the lowdown and the breakdown of all of the major underreported stories of the past several years. We're joined right now by James Petras. He is the retired Bartle Professor of Sociology at Binghamton University in Binghamton, New York, and adjunct professor at St. Mary's University, Halifax, Nova Scotia, in Canada. He's the author of over 62 books, has authored more than 600 articles in professional journals and over 2,000 articles in non-professional journals, including The New York Times, The Guardian, The Nation, Christian Science Monitor, New Left Review, and Global Research. He joins us now by phone. So it's a pleasure to have you back on the Global Research News Hour, Professor Petras.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's always a pleasure working with you folks and collaborating with Michelle Chosudovsky and other people at the at your center.
Now, let's talk first a bit. We're coming to the end of 2015, and there have been a number of very interesting developments over the course of the last year. We've had, of course, the election of this Syriza government in Greece, the world economic crisis, the recent defeat of the Chavistas in Venezuela, the Russian military airstrikes against ISIS, the Corbyn victory in the UK, Netanyahu's victory in Israel, Black Lives Matter, the Paris bombings, and the Iranian nuclear deal. So I'm wondering if there's anything in that list or maybe things that I haven't mentioned yet that really stand out for you as having been a particularly pivotal moment of this past year.
Well, you enumerated some of the mixed results for the year. I would say overall the 2015 had a negative picture overall. Despite some positive developments, I think we can run down quickly what I think are the positive developments. I think the Russian invitation by the Syrian government is a very positive development because Russia really put the squeeze on ISIS, bombing its oil shipments, which are one of the major sources of funding, and in general providing some support, significant support in the fight against terrorism. I think in part that is a expression of Russia's geopolitical interests, but also the fact that many of the terrorists come from the Caucasus, in particular Chechens, who then pick up their arms and skills going back to Russia to engage in terrorist activity. And all of this is tied in with the identification of Turkey as the main conduit for money, oil sales, and arms for the terrorists. And I think this is has gradually penetrated public opinion. The second point that I think was positive was Corbyn's victory in the Labour Party. I think it's symbolic that the grassroots in England, the grassroots of the Labour Party, diverges very significantly from its parliamentary leadership, and they were able to elect Corbyn. But I think his capacity to take the Labour Party in a different direction will require a drastic change in the composition of the Labour Party representatives in the Parliament. And even his so-called shadow cabinet is infested with warmongers and a pretty reactionary bunch of right-wing social democrats. The main positive developments in the Western Hemisphere essentially is the U.S. Opening up relations with Cuba, Cuba and the U.S. signing off on a number of protocols and changes. Just today, the agreement to start commercial flights directly from the U.S. to Cuba, and gradually the distension in relations is a step in the right direction, though the U.S. still hasn't lifted the economic blockade of Cuba.
What is another pivotal event of the past year?
I think there's three that I can mention. One is the deal with Iran, the nuclear deal for ending the embargo. I think that's positive. It bucked the pressure from the Israeli lobby in the U.S., which was for war with Iran rather than peace and a settlement. So that was a major breakthrough, that we didn't go to into another war mode, and the fact that the Israeli lobby, which up to recently had total control over U.S. Middle Eastern policy, was dealt a severe setback, at least temporarily. I think that's a big step. Anytime you defeat the Israeli warmongers, you have to say that that's a benchmark. The other thing that I noticed that I thought was significant was the Pope's statement on earth warming, his attacks on neoliberal capitalism, what he calls savage capitalism, the dung of the devil, as he referred to it in a picturesque phrase. I think his speaking out for social justice sets a new a framework for which the Christian leaders play a positive role rather than backing warmongers and aggression. And finally, I think an ambiguous step forward was the whole discussion and recognition worldwide of climate change and the necessary that it's human causation, that it's usually overlooked, and particularly in the U.S., where the Congress still refuses to recognize climate change, and as induced by the U.S. and other countries. However, I must say that the lack of any enforcement mechanism, and the fact that the U.S. Congress is bucking any regulations, makes it a more symbolic change. And I think the defeat of Harper, though Trudeau is not any great shakes, the fact that a right-wing extremist like Harper was defeated shows at least some limitations on right-wing extremism in North America. These positive developments have to be set against what I think is a very powerful negative a current that developed throughout the year. I think the fact that the U.S. is patrolling the Chinese frontier, maritime areas, I think this is a very negative development and has implications for a possible global war, the U.S. refusing to recognize China as a co-equal and using its military muscle to try to limit China's role in the world economy, and particularly the setting up of this Trans-Pacific treaty excluding China. I think these are all belligerent and negative developments on a worldwide scale. I think other issues are like the boycott of Russia, which is a very negative factor because Russia supported the Democratic Federalists in eastern Ukraine and opposed the seizure of power in Kiev. This boycott, of course, has a two-way street. It negatively impacts on trading relations between Europe and Russia. It harms both sides and is not warranted. They should sit down and arrange a democratic settlement of recognizing Ukrainian democratic aspirations and linguistic pluralism. And also allow for the eastern Ukrainians to have greater self-government. And then the fact that they're boycotting Russia and building up military installations on Russia's border is also a threat to world peace. The other issues that I think are important is the right-wing victories in Argentina and Venezuela and the push to impeach the elected government in Brazil, the government of Dilma Rousseff. These right-wing victories are a threat to all of the social gains that were accumulated in these countries in the past decade and a half. And I think they will lead to severe conflict and hopefully not violence. But if these new governments begin to try to roll back social legislation, wage gains, et cetera, there's going to be very virulent resistance from the organized trade union movements, the neighborhoods, et cetera. And this is a very negative development. The big bad news in Europe, I would say, is the collapse of Syriza into a collaborator with the European Union, voted them in on the basis that they would not impose massive privatizations and even greater deprivation on the population. Instead, they signed off on an agreement which is worse than existed under the previous right-wing governments, and this undermined the left-wing cycle that was developing in Portugal and Spain. We see now that Podemos, the other left-wing group in Spain, has moved toward the center and lost support, by the way. And we see that the left in Portugal has joined with the right-wing social democrats in a coalition. So that great hopes that people had in the new left in southern Europe, it seems to me a much more dubious proposition.
Finally, I just wanted to see what, given all those developments, if you'd care to suggest what they bode going into 2016. What do you think we can look forward to?
Well, I think this political spectrum has moved in a zigzag way, but it's moving more to the right. I think the U.S. election is a signpost here, with the Trump likely being the right-wing extremist candidate for the Republican Party, and Hillary Clinton, notorious warmonger and Israel firster, being the nominee from the Democratic Party. I think this is a poor set of choices, and I think that's not, doesn't bode well for peace and justice, not only in the United States but worldwide. The second thing I think that one can say is that there'll be intensifying social conflict and regression in economic terms in Latin America. We're going to see a lot more of class warfare and polarization in Venezuela and elsewhere, which were relatively peaceful, developing center-left societies, now are being highly polarized, and I think we'll see a lot of conflict there. Mm-hmm. Finally, I think the situation in the Middle East is going to become more militarized. I think the double game that the West is playing of criticizing ISIS and then supplying them with arms directly or indirectly, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, U.S., and others engaged in this double game, I think we're going to see a perpetuation of instability and warfare in the Middle East. Yemen joining the PAC, dictatorships in Egypt, and a climate in which no easy road to peace and justice.
Well, on that note, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us, James Petras. And notwithstanding those past projections you made, we'll wish you all the best for 2016.
Yeah, I wish I could say more in a positive vein, but I think we would be fooling ourselves. We have to prepare ourselves for the long, long struggle.
James Petras is a retired Bartle Professor of Sociology at Binghamton University in Binghamton. He's an author. He is also a frequent contributor to the Global Research website. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM.
You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Thank you for sticking with the Global Research News Hour for the past year. We'll return again in 2016 with more regular programming.